Welcome to your Senate Elections Committee.
And welcome to the House Committee on Elections, Ethics, and Rules.
Thanks, everyone, for being here. We have a few other legislators that will be attending, and then we have some folks that want to appear by phone during the afternoon, so we may experience technical difficulties. But we're going to go ahead and get started. We have a lot of material to get through. I'm going to invite up Ms. Gina Zedlick from Oregon Legislative Council to talk a little bit about Ballot Measure 9 and what happened in 1994. And then we'll move forward with Janice Thompson, Democracy Reform on Public Financing. So, thank you. Appreciate you being here today.
Oh, thank you. Chair Brown, Chair Rosendahl, members of committee, my name is Gina Zedlick from Legislative Council. I'm going to start today just by going kind of all the way back to the early 1900s because I think that that gives the context necessary to understand
quickly. We only have 3 hours.
Well, to understand Ballot Measure 9 and the court's holding in Van Natta v. Kiesling, which will determine any future efforts at regulating campaign finance here in Oregon. Before 1975, there was a couple, there were different things that restricted campaign contributions and expenditures in Oregon. But by 1973, only two statutes existed that regulated campaign expenditures by political treasurers running campaigns, and the other by any person without approval of a candidate. These two measures were looked at by the Oregon Supreme Court in Darris v. Myers in 1975. It was the first time the court had looked at campaign finance here in Oregon under the Oregon Constitution. That court decided that campaign expenditures violated Article 1, Section 8 of the Oregon Constitution, which is our freedom of expression clause here in Oregon, similar to the First Amendment in the U.S. Constitution. The court in Darris v. Myers assumed that expenditures were protected, and therefore they held the statutes unconstitutional. About a year later, Buckley v. Valeo came down deciding, looking at campaign contributions and campaign expenditures under the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. That was in 1976, and they looked at the Federal Elections Campaign Act and a lot of different things relevant to our topic here today in discussion of Ballot Measure 9. They looked at campaign contributions and campaign expenditures. The U.S. Supreme Court differentiated between campaign contributions and expenditures. They decided that expenditures by a candidate was the only way that a candidate needed to spend money in order to communicate political ideas, and that expenditures were essentially core political speech and therefore subject to strict scrutiny when looking at regulations and whether those regulations violated the First Amendment. Therefore, and as a practical matter, when the U.S. Supreme Court looks at things with strict scrutiny, not much gets by it. So therefore, that's why at the federal level and at our state level, we don't have restrictions on campaign expenditures. The U.S. Supreme Court went on to look at campaign contributions. Contributions, unlike expenditures, they found were more symbolic speech. They were, if I give money to a candidate, it doesn't get transformed into political speech until it is actually spent by that candidate. So therefore, the court decided that you can regulate campaign contributions some. There's still scrutiny required. You still have to balance it, the government's interest against the First Amendment, violation of the First Amendment. But the U.S. Supreme Court seemed very convinced by the idea that preventing corruption and the appearance of corruption validated some restrictions on campaign contributions. So that's your framework. So when Ballot Measure 9 comes along in 1994, proposed by the people of Oregon, those are the only two things, that's the only guidance they had when writing that law. They knew that the Oregon Supreme Court said expenditures, any regulations on expenditures were not okay, and they knew at the U.S. Supreme Court level expenditure regulations were not okay. But they also knew that the U.S. Supreme Court decided under the First Amendment that some campaign contribution limits were okay under the U.S. Constitution. So I imagine they thought it might be likely if they use similar limits as in Buckley v. Valeo that maybe the Oregon Supreme Court would find under Article 1, Section 8 similarly to the U.S. Supreme Court. So Measure 9 went to the ballot and was passed by a majority of the voters in 1995 and became law. Ballot Measure 9 did three major things. It limited campaign contributions similar to the way that the Federal Elections Campaign Act did when considered by Buckley v. Valeo. It imposed voluntary expenditure limits, and it prescribed certain uses of campaign funds. So the court looked at, first started looking at the contribution limits, similar to the ones that were considered by the U.S. Supreme Court in Buckley v. Valeo. The Oregon court is here where it differs pretty drastically from the U.S. Supreme Court. The Oregon court was not convinced that expenditures are very different from contributions. Contributions, campaign contributions, were just as much speech as expenditures by a candidate. They thought they were it was the speech by the contributor in support of a candidate. And so, therefore, the court found that under Article 1, Section 8 of the Oregon Constitution, both campaign expenditures and campaign contributions were equally protected. The court then went through and looked at those contribution limits and did our Article 1, Section 8 freedom of expression analysis. And the court found that those regulations didn't fit into any of the exceptions. Our court generally has three exceptions: a historical exception if something violates Article 1, Section 8. If it's been around since the beginning of time, then maybe that's okay. It has, if it is directed at a specific harm, our court decided that campaign contributions didn't necessarily lead to undue influence, and so therefore it didn't fit under that exception. And finally, what's called the incompatibility exception, that accepting limits on campaign contributions were, that those regulations were necessary to make sure that our legislative leaders weren't acting incompatible with their office. So the court went through all those steps and found that these regulations on campaign contributions in Ballot Measure 9, they just violated the Article 1, Section 8, and they did not fit into any of the exceptions. And I can go into more detail of this, of course, if you'd like me to, but this is, I think, how we get to where we are today. The court went on to, so after the court invalidated all the contribution limits, the court went on to look at the voluntary expenditure limits. This, the court found, was constitutional under the Oregon Constitution, the voluntary limits. So those survived Van Atta v. Kiesling. And finally, I think all we have left today from Ballot Measure 9 are the limits on personal use of campaign funds. So that survived as well. However, even though voluntary expenditure limits survived, those were repealed, I don't know, maybe a few years later. They're not on our books anymore today. And so I think the biggest thing to take away from Ballot Measure 9 and our court's decision is that you have the First Amendment, which regulates any action that Oregon chooses to take in regulating campaign finance. So that's the first thing you need to think about. And then the second is Oregon is much more restricted by Oregon's own constitution than the U.S. Constitution. And that's why today when we look at, you know, Measure 46 and 47, which will be talked about later, I understand, that's why we need a constitutional amendment to overcome the decision in Van Atta v. Kiesling in order to regulate campaign contributions. So I think that's my read of Ballot Measure 9, and if you'd like me to answer any more specific questions on that, I would be more than happy to.
Thank you. Questions?
And Gina, was that a unanimous decision of the state Supreme Court in Van Atta?
Yeah, there were no dissents. So,
And they did not rely on anything in the U.S. Constitution, but only the Oregon Constitution.
They acknowledged Buckley v. Valeo, but they didn't dispute the U.S. Supreme Court's decision on the First Amendment, but they decided that Article 1, Section 8 of our Constitution is different and is more restrictive than the First Amendment. And so that's so they differed in the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court, in analyzing our provision of the Oregon Constitution.
Okay. Representative Buckley.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah,
because we're talking about him. Are you really the Buckley that was in that case?
No. That's my older brother. Gina, can you remind us what the voluntary limits were in Measure 9?
Sure. Please. They did. Let's see. So three things. They set out statutory limits that you could either agree to or not agree to. So if you agreed to them, they were prescribed by statute, certain monetary limits.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that went along with that is that it would be written up, the Secretary of State would include in the voter's pamphlet that you, A, submitted to the voluntary limits. I think it would also state if you did not submit to the voluntary limits. And then if you subjected yourself to the voluntary limits but then didn't abide by them, the next election cycle, it would also state that in the voter's pamphlet if you're running for re-election. And then finally, it took away that you were only allowed to get a tax credit as a contributor if you were contributing to a campaign that submitted to the voluntary expenditure limits.
And because this was actually, in effect, the first election cycle I ran for office, there also was a provision that if you had an opponent who had agreed to voluntarily limit expenditures and then went over that amount, that released everybody who had agreed to limit expenditures from the limits. So you didn't mention that, but that was actually my experience. Was I had an opponent who didn't agree to limit. I had pledged to limit it, and so that was listed in the voter's pamphlet, but yet nobody who was running for that position, because one candidate had not voluntarily limited their amounts, everybody was released from it. So it was really, I think, part of the reason it was repealed, because that was routinely what was happening then, is that if one candidate decided not to do it, nobody had to follow it, and yet you still got the benefit of having in the voter's pamphlet, you know, so-and-so has agreed to these limits. So it just wasn't really accomplishing anything.
And my other question would be, my sense is, and I guess I'm looking more for your perspective, my sense is, my recollection was that the limits were fairly restrictive. I can't remember the limits, $100, maybe $500 for individuals. But my sense is that there's no limit in terms of the court's ruling, and there's not a lot of wiggle room there in terms of our ability to work. The limit amount was not a factor. It was a fact that it was limited in any way.
The expenditures.
Yes.
Right.
But the contributors as well.
I don't know if I am understanding your question.
Okay, let me think if I can rephrase it, and I'll come back. Anybody else?
I think the voluntary limits that were allowed to stay in effect by the court were only expenditure limits.
They were only expenditure
they
limits.
They totally threw
right.
out
you
the
could,
contribution
because,
limits.
Right. Under the First Amendment, expenditures can't be touched. It was the
right.
fact they were voluntary. It was the only reason they
okay.
were
okay. Okay. But the contributional limit amount, mm-hmm. there's no wiggle room in terms of our ability to limit contributions. That's not based on an amount. That's the fact that you're limiting free speech in any way. Is that correct?
No, you can limit. Well, under the Oregon Constitution, you can't limit them at all right
okay.
now.
Okay. That's... Under the federal, there's clearly...
Right.
Okay.
Right.
All right. Other questions? Thanks. That's a really fabulous 100-year analysis in 15 minutes or less. I'm impressed. So thanks for joining us. We appreciate your time today.
Thanks for having me.
So. All right. Next up, Janice Thompson. And she's going to be talking a little bit about how public financing fits into campaign finance reform. And she's got great colored sheets, I can tell.
Good afternoon. Janice Thompson, with Democracy Reform Oregon. So my assignment is to talk about how public funding fits into all of this. Basically, public financing gets called lots of different things, you know, clean money, clean elections, voter-owned elections, fair and clean elections, citizen elections. It gets called a variety of things. And it's basically the only constitutional way to get people to agree to spending limits because it's voluntary. But unlike the Measure 9's voluntary spending limits, there's a little bit more of a carrot, which is the public funding piece. You know, that the you're agreeing to a spending limit that's the amount of public resources that are provided for you to run a campaign. And most of the current discussions are related to something that's called full public funding. There are several cities in particular that have partial public funding systems with kind of more of a match program. And, you know, depending on how those are designed, they can meet a number of reform goals. But to link it to what you just heard, the key element of public financing is if, you know, there's an interest in trying to limit spending overall, this is the constitutional way to do it, and it is predicated on it being voluntary. But as an organization, you know, we link it to, you know, okay, what are our goals? And so this goldenrod sheet begins with, you know, the goals that we have. You know, if you're going to talk about reform, it's like, what are you trying to accomplish? So we're interested in reform that would increase competition and voter choice as well as opportunities, not only in terms of who can run for office, but really to allow kind of typical folks a more meaningful role in candidate selection. That during the campaigns themselves, that the reform should benefit voters by increasing opportunities for conversations with constituents and reduce, you know, the you know, fundraising time demands. Then the reform should benefit community interests by, you know, starting to shift some of the legislative decision-making in terms of elected officials being, you know, less beholden to provide access and or assistance to campaign contributors. And it also should be legal. And this is an area that's fraught with, you know, different legal areas. So the two reform strategies that are out there are public financing, which, as I say, is the legal way to get people to limit spending because it's a voluntary cap, and limits on contributions. And under the federal First Amendment, there can also be bans on contributions from corporate and union treasuries. And as you just heard, kind of the legal environment that Oregon operates in with regards to limits is a little bit different than other states, which is why we're literally just, you know, part of a handful of states with no contribution limits. I think it's very important to realize that these strategies are not mutually exclusive, and in fact, you know, they work well together, and that the development of full public funding strategies really occurred in the 1990s in response to people taking a look at a number of states that did develop contribution limits, particularly, you know, in the post-Watergate era, there was a lot of, you know, the $100 limits kind of along the lines of Measure 9. And there was concern that these comprehensive reform goals really weren't being met, you know, that there may be a piece of the puzzle, but not the entire piece of the puzzle. The pink sheet, I'll just let you kind of take a look at, you know, at your leisure, but this is just this, we're a data organization, so this is some information on, you know, key facts and figures regarding money in Oregon politics. And one of the key things there is to realize that the size of contributions just is, you know, in a non-limits environment is kind of continuing to ratchet up. The one factoid, however, in Table 1 that I will note with regards to the 1996 election is that one thing that does occur when you limit contributions is, you know, oftentimes people use the water balloon analogy. The money wants to go somewhere. And so in 96, in that column in Table 1, there was a jump up in primarily independent expenditures. The reporting paradigm for independent expenditures was such that it's, you know, difficult to say definitively before that election there were no independent expenditures, but I think it's fair to say there weren't very many. And it's also fair to say that after the 96 election there also weren't very many. So this is another dynamic that public funding addresses by providing, typically, depending on the exact program design, providing matching funds if a participating candidate is targeted. Sometimes people, like in North Carolina, they call it rescue funds and rebuttal funds. But providing matching funds up to a limit. Again, it's not like a bottomless pocket. But for if a participating candidate faces either a non-participating, you know, privately funded opponent who goes over the spending cap, or independent expenditures. And, you know, independent expenditures are very frustrating to candidates, and it's probably the area where the legal environment that this topic exists under and kind of people's policy interests kind of are, you know, at the most cross purposes. With there being some limits on independent expenditures, again, if they're funded by corporate or union treasury dollars, it's being okay to limit, but independent expenditures by individuals not, at least if you kind of stay within the legal paradigm of the federal level in most other states. But this is just, you know, some information about, like, you know, what does the data tell us? The data tells us that, you know, the size of contributions is really getting up there. Now, public financing, as I mentioned, you know, in this kind of most recent realm of interest kind of started to grow during the 1990s. Probably the first mention of it in American politics is actually, however, Teddy Roosevelt. He was quite a proponent of this, as I understand it. And then there was also discussion in that kind of post-Watergate era in the early 70s about congressional public financing programs. That's when the presidential kind of partial public funding program was designed. And in fact, the legislation that was, you know, passed in that era was what parts of it were what triggered the you know, Representative Buckley's older brother going to court in Buckley v. Valeo. Now, I don't want to, the kind of gray colored handout is just kind of informational item for you in anticipation of possible questions. The presidential public funding program is widely considered to be broken. People shouldn't be surprised that, you know, folks are not opting into it. And so this is just a summary of some legislation from at the federal level for 2006 to fix it. So this is just kind of a, you know, I just wanted to anticipate the possibility of people asking, you know, what is that presidential system, and, you know, why is it that, like, you know, Senator Obama is not opting in? But I'll just leave that for your reading pleasure. But as part of that that package that was passed in that post-Watergate era, like I say, the Buckley case did come out of that. The Buckley case directly addressed public funding. And the quote is, the Congress may engage in public financing of election campaigns and may condition acceptance of public funds on an agreement by the candidate to abide by specified expenditure limits, et cetera, et cetera. So there's very clear language in Buckley saying, okay, we don't think you can do this and this. You can still do this. And public financing is okay. So that's, you know, part of the, you know, legal environment. Like I say, I don't think they're kind of an either or. In the history, back to that goldenrod sheet, at the bottom of it summarizes the jurisdictions where public funding is in place. This is in alphabetical order, though if you go to the far-hand column, you'll see that the earliest adoption was through the initiative process in 1996 in Maine. And so the program there applies to their statewide offices, which is just their governor, and legislative races. And it was adopted through the initiative process in 96. It went into effect in 2000. And it's in the 80 to 85% range of their legislature runs, you know, operates under this. I've talked with, you know, with public officials from Maine who just say, this is how we do business. We like it. And they attribute, you know, a number of healthcare provisions in particular that they feel like they have been able to adopt because it's not like people don't come in and lobby them, and they want that information, but it's not quite, you know, coming along with the, you know, the fact that somebody else made a big campaign contribution. Now, so then Arizona was next. That was the other state using the initiative process. You'll see that increasingly, however, legislative adoption is occurring. And I think that's occurring for two reasons. One is, well, there are actually our states where the initiative process obviously isn't, you know, an option, so that's a big factor. But I think the other factor is, you know, legislators, you know, recognizing that, you know, they're kind of everybody's stuck in a bad system. And there's also, I think, an awareness of, yes, this is public funds, but, you know, they have, you know, the kind of knowledge of the budget to put it into perspective. And obviously, you know, the political dynamics of public financing are obviously influenced by the fact of it being public dollars. In that regard, I think it's very, very important to realize that the current private money system isn't free. And just in this morning's Oregonian, you might have noticed a very long opinion piece about the current financial crisis. And the pullout quote is, "And why has Congress been so silent? The Wall Street investment banking firms, their executives, their families, and their political action committees contribute more to U.S. Senate and House campaigns than any other industry in America." So the current system isn't free. In fact, it may be costing us $700 billion. So that, I think, when you talk about, you know, from a policy perspective, the ins and out, I mean, that it does need to be part of the discussion. And this is after the initial success in adopting these reforms through the ballot measure process, there have been failures bringing it before the public in that arena. One of them was in Oregon in 1990, ballot measure 6 lost. It was, you know, each state's, you know, have different little angles fit to their particular political jurisdictions, but it was still the basic, you know, small, you collect a large number of small qualifying $5 contributions, you know, eligible for a chunk of public funds to use for legitimate campaign expenses, and then that's it. More recently, there was a ballot measure in California that was kind of a mixed bag. It was not just a public funding measure, which kind of complicated things. And then more recently, there was a loss in Alaska. So, you know, this is a, you know, politically challenging reform strategy. But it does seem to be the one option out there that does kind of more, it is more of a paradigm shift and starts to kind of take a look at, or starts to address the four reform goals, you know, that I have mentioned. And the final just informational note is that there are also, and it's why I included the purple sheet, is that though the Buckley-Valeo decision points to the validity of public financing and it has been upheld, it's not like there have not been legal challenges. And most recently, there have been some renewed challenges based on some discussion by in a decision called last summer, June. I guess I don't know if we're still in summer or not. But in June of this year, there was the Supreme Court struck down what was called the Millionaires Amendment. And I'll just leave you to read this purple sheet. But this is from the Brennan Center for Justice. And, you know, some of the other discussions on this topic have been things along the lines of, you know, the reports of the death of public financing have been, you know, greatly exaggerated. That said, this is, you know, again, part of the real dynamic that this topic exists under, where, you know, people have disagreements and they will come out in court. So my hope is just to kind of put this, you know, give some background, give you some sense of where it's out there and the successes and challenges. And then happy to...
Questions. Representative Shields.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Janice, Measure 6, you mentioned, you said 1990. I think you meant...
No. I said, yeah, 2000. Excuse me. Thank you.
So Measure 6 and Measure 9, do you remember who was funding the opposition to those?
There was actually, as I recall, I was just looking at this recently, I'm not sure that there was even an opposition PAC formed against Measure 9. There was definitely opposition to Measure 6, and the funding was from some key lobbying individuals, some names you would be very familiar with.
Could you be more specific?
Mark Nelson comes to mind. I have to double check.
I would be interested in it. I would be interested in finding out who opposed it and what. You know,
I'd be happy to give you that.
Some of the bigger groups that they were lobbying for.
Representative Thatcher.
Thank you. On the goldenrod sheet, mm-hmm. Janice, that you handed out, there's some campaign finance reform goals, and then at the bottom, there's a table of those states or jurisdictions that have adopted some form.
Right.
And I'm wondering if there's been any analysis as to whether those goals have been met where those reforms were adopted.
Yes. In both Maine and Arizona, particularly in Maine, in part because of just some other political dynamics, an increase in competition. In Connecticut, where the legislature adopted it in 2005 and it's kind of going into effect this cycle, their participation in the program, I think, is 85%, and they anticipate significant more competition in legislative races in Connecticut. Janet Napolitano in Arizona was the first governor ever elected using the reform option, and one of her notable quotes was that she promised, and it was able, she felt like she could keep this promise because of not having had to, you know, take private money contributions from some of the key players involved in this discussion. But the day after she was sworn in, she signed a executive order ordering state agencies to do bulk purchasing of prescription drugs, which was something that the Arizona legislature had not, you know, gotten to. Now, I understand that, you know, that's, you know, an issue that this legislature has addressed, but there are those kinds of discussions in terms of, I think that one of the examples, another example from Arizona was funding all-day kindergarten. I mean, there are some, I think both in the competition, this is an area where, you know, the academic research is, you know, starting to get into in terms of coming up with those successes, but it's definitely starting to bear fruit.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Janice, in terms of funding the publicly funded elections, I believe Arizona adds a surcharge to traffic tickets, if I have that correct, and other violations, but I'm not sure what Connecticut does or what they've decided to do. Can you give us some of the examples of what the funding sources have been?
Sure. In Arizona, part of their funding mechanism is a surcharge on not just speeding tickets, but civil and criminal fines. In the policy discussion that led to the development of Measure 6, this was a strategy that was explicitly not, part of the Measure 6 discussion. Partly there were just some differences in between the two states in terms of, you know, having the structural pieces in place to do that weren't quite in place here at the time. But it was mainly an equity issue. One of the items that's noted in that handout and was part of the funding mechanism of Measure 6 was to repeal and to use the cost savings of the political tax credit, which we actually have a form of public funding right now in the political tax credit. I think it's fair to say that it has not met these reform goals. And so part of that funding mechanism, and it was also needed to not have kind of competing public funding programs, was to repeal the use of the political tax credit by candidates who could opt into the reform program and use those cost savings. Connecticut is allocating the money from unclaimed property. North Carolina, it was the first to adopt it for judicial elections, and that's been kind of an interesting area of conversation. Washington State is considering that. Wisconsin came pretty close, the Wisconsin court, the West Virginia. The new North Carolina program is a combination, I believe, of general funds, and there is a fee added to licensing for attorneys. They don't like it very much. The attorneys don't. So that's not one I would recommend. So you kind of see the policy nexus, but, you know. So this is where it's really important, even if kind of there are some basic policy similarities from jurisdiction to jurisdiction, it's very important that the key policy questions be answered in site-specific ways. And that's particularly in terms of what the qualifying requirements should be, what the public funding allocation should be, and the funding mechanism. But those are some of the examples out there.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thanks. Janice, a couple of quick things. One, just to follow up on Representative Thatcher's question about sort of analysis. One of the goals that I think is important about campaign finance reform is increasing diversity so that our governing bodies look like our populations. Arizona, probably a little difficult, pretty diverse state to begin with, but I'm curious if the legislatures of Maine and Arizona, in terms of gender breakdown, have changed as a result of public financing or in terms of racial backgrounds.
There's been more evidence in Arizona than in Maine, partly particularly in terms of race and ethnicity, you know, Maine is quite homogeneous. Mm-hmm. But the number of Latino candidates has definitely increased, and you know, people who have won using the system. So that's the dynamic. The gender issue. Has been a little bit more mixed. I think people are starting to see, you know, the trend. There's something that came out recently on that. I'll track that down and get it for you.
All right. Other question. What is your organization's concerns about independent expenditures, and what are the positive sides about independent expenditures? I mean, mm-hmm. I think that's one of the issues with the limits is. Inevitably, we're looking at then independent expenditures, and what does that mean?
Well, it's important, as I mentioned, you know, it is an area where the legal environment and kind of policy interests kind of don't mesh very well. At the same time, I think it's important not to completely, you know, vilify independent expenditures. They're a piece of the political landscape, and I think where they have, I think where they have been, you know, a valid and helpful part of the discussion, are particularly when independent expenditures comes from groups that are clear about who they are. They're not just, you know, paying for something that looks exactly like, you know, what came from the candidate, And they're saying, you know, we're group X. These are our issues. This is why we think, you know, candidate Y is, you know, the one to go for. It is also the other point with regards to independent expenditures in Oregon is that it's important to realize that Oregon law actually has a very appropriately, I think, broad definition of independent expenditures. There is like these kind of famous footnote, the magic words test, which is literally out of footnotes in Buckley, about independent expenditures being defined as, you know, having some of the so-called magic words, you know, vote for, against, things like that. Actually, there was litigation in Oregon that grew out of the 1996 election about what was an issue ad. And evidently, the people who wanted to release that ad took it to the Secretary of State's office, who said, well, under our law, this is not going to trigger any reporting requirements. And, you know, it was like an issue ad as opposed to like the magic words test. So that actually went up, there's no longer that kind of, you know, magic words test distinction in Oregon law. It uses more what I think is popularly considered kind of the reasonable person test. Any reasonable person would look at this and realize it's a campaign ad. So in terms of public financing, the matching funds are provided if somebody is targeted in that way. So that's, it's more money for more speech.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Andrew. At least from my perspective, what I've seen in the public financing of elections in the city of Portland, it sort of looked like a wreck from where I'm standing. And I wondered if you thought there were any lessons that could be taken away from the effort at public financing in Portland.
I have two detailed reports I could leave with you.
Oh, good.
They were longer than I made copies for, but for you, I have.
I'll ask the staff to take those.
But there have been issues. There have been issues in other jurisdictions as well, and it points to you need to have good administration.
Right.
That has been the biggest problem in Portland, and it's been very frustrating to me.
Well, I'll ask for copies to be made available to other
sure.
community
members.
Madam Chair, I have a question about one of the handouts.
Sure.
In the pink or the salmon colored handout.
I thought
salmon was the organizing principle of Western civilization, so.
No, pink is.
Okay.
Or it's going to be.
In 2006, you indicated that the total contributions to legislative candidates were $20 million. And I assume you're getting that right off of the websites from the Secretary of State's office for campaign expenditures.
Yeah, we get the data. We get a big data dump, and we have it in our own database, yeah.
Data dump is probably the right term.
Yep.
Okay. And I noticed that you've broken down the sectoral analysis to show that 49% of the total comes from business.
Mm-hmm.
We're looking at the 06. And 11% came from the labor.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wondered if you had really had anybody tear apart these numbers and look at the designations, how you arrived at those designations. And the reason I ask that is that I handed out, and you have a copy, of the Department of Administrative Services printout for the collections that were made for labor unions on behalf of labor unions in 2006. And it shows that the public employees unions collected $15,600,000 over that period of time, none of which is used for retirements or health care costs. They are used for outreach, education, political action, and those kinds of things. This doesn't include the OEA collections. This is just the public employees unions, and the OEA collections are total about the same amount of money. So there were $30 million available for use, potentially for public action, and yet apparently only $2 million were used. And
well,
so I'm questioning whether or not there are a lot of other expenditures that are going on in electioneering, transportation costs, training, whatever you want to call it, that isn't a direct campaign type identifier. And I wondered if 11% isn't vastly underestimating what actually is going into elections, given the fact that potentially there's $30 million available in 06 and $30 million available in 07 for, and I'm sure I'll like them out this year, for potentially for election purposes.
Senator Farrelly, I do think this is an accurate figure, and what the issue is, this is just the legislative candidates. And off the top of my head, I think I looked at this once. I tried to come up with a number of like where all the other money was going, you know, it's to non-candidate. This is just to candidate, you know, principal campaign funds of candidates. So there's money going to, you know, leadership funds. There's money going to, right to life's PAC, basic rights. Or I mean, there's any number of issue PACs. There's statewide candidates, and the other critical thing is there's ballot measures. So this $20 million, I don't know if it was that year. I mean, I think it was like $100 million. Let me double check on this, but if I'm off by a magnitude or more, I'll get back to you. But I think I'll be pretty close in the ballpark. That when you kind of added all that up, we were talking more like $150 million. So I think that is then where that number fits into better.
Madam Chairman, I appreciate that. I think the issue is one that we need to explore. It's one that deserves legislative attention. But I guess at some point in time we have to do a sort of truthing of where all the money goes, because if, in fact, only $2 million out of 30 is getting into the legislative races, we're getting ripped off. and if not, I want to know where the rest is going, and it'd be really interesting to follow the money to see where it's going.
Because
there's a lot of money going somewhere here, and it obviously isn't showing up in the C&E reports. Thank you, ma'am.
Senator Farrelly, I guess as I read this analysis, and I could be wrong, you have a
of the your grand totaling each year at $16 million, and if you look at the columns, a portion of that for dues, portion of that for fair share, and roughly 800,000 of that is for political action committees. So that's the portion of those dollars going towards political work, I believe. But I'm sure we can have someone come in and explain this.
And Madam Chairman, I think that'd be a good and fruitful discussion, because I believe that if the membership votes the dues for a specific purpose, that's what it gets used for.
Well,
fair share is paid by those who are not union members, and the PAC money is a specific contribution, but it doesn't mean that dues money won't end up as a PAC contribution.
Madam Chair, Representative Rosenbaum.
Senator Ferrioli, I didn't mean to take the floor from you. I actually did want to respond to your last question, though, and I am by no means an elections lawyer or a labor lawyer, but I do know something about unions and how money is collected and used. And I can tell you, at least as somebody who was and still is a member of a private sector union, that in the private sector, under federal labor law, and actually I think every one of our public employee unions in Oregon also represents people in the private sector, unions have to fill out voluminous paperwork that you would be shocked at, I think, if you had to fill it out like a union treasurer has to account for every penny of money that's collected as union dues, whether it's by fair share payers or people who are members of the union. And it isn't just campaign contributions, which are stringently regulated, but it's also all the other money that's collected. So if that money is used for bargaining or organizing, or if it's used to hold a rally for a political purpose, you know, or anything like that, you have to spell out exactly how you are spending that money. And I could show you people who've gone to jail for signing those reports were volunteers because they didn't accurately or honestly report how union dues are spent. This is probably a preview of the debate we're going to have over ballot measure 60, because I think that's certainly in front of voters this time. But I can tell you that it is strictly regulated. So, you know, if anybody thinks that unions are able to hide the ball financially, I just don't think it's true. But that wasn't my question.
Yeah, I'm sure. I don't know that it's about unions hiding the ball so much as it is about us, when we talk about these things, making sure that we're all talking about the same kind of expenditures and where the money goes. For instance, if you were doing an educational outreach and it was a rally, is that a traditionally reportable campaign contribution? And I would say if it was my attorney, he'd say no, you know, if I didn't want it to be.
I think, Senator Ferrioli, you do raise a point. I think there's certainly a level of in-kind campaign contributions that, if they're not reported, they're hard to track. I don't think there's any question about that. And I can give you a number of examples, i.e., you know, people volunteering service, people who are in a professional capacity volunteering services on a campaign. Is that an in-kind contribution? And if so, shouldn't that be reported? I think that's a really good example. I think we struggle with how to enforce that. But I do think, you know, having watched both labor and the business community and our reporting system, is that folks, when they're making expenditures on behalf of candidates, are very clear to report it, because the fines are significant for failure to comply. Janice, and then we'll go back to Madam Chair.
So two just quick things. That's why, I mean, table one, I tried to be so clear about what it was and what it wasn't. It's just direct contributions to legislative candidates. I would also say Oregon, I think Oregon, in-kind contributions in Oregon are actually very well reported.
Right.
Now, this is, I'm not saying that there's not, you know, perfect, but this is based on conversations with people from organizations like mine elsewhere that kind of tear their hair out about, you know, much less clear reporting than we see in Oregon.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Madam Chair.
Thank you. But what is true in Oregon is that contributions can be made from union treasury dollars, just like they can from corporate coffers, no matter what source they come from. And that's really because of Oregon's lack of limits on where you can get money. I mean, in Oregon, you can take money from anybody in any state from any source, really. So I guess that was really the question, my area of question. So I had two questions for you, Janice. One was, you don't list among your goals for campaign finance reform just surely limiting the amount of money that is raised or spent in campaigns, which maybe people don't care about that, but I think that that actually is a legitimate goal, is to just sort of drive down the cost, because one of the things I hear all the time, especially at this time of year, is people, you know, in an economy such as we're in now, are just appalled at the sheer amount of money that's going into races at all levels from president on down, and people say things like, well, gosh, you know, if so-and-so just put that money into solving the problem instead of, you know, buying TV time, it could go a long way. So I'm just curious whether you think that's a legitimate goal, and if it is, do any of these systems that you're talking about do a better job of limiting the sheer amount of money in the system?
Representative Rosenbaum, I mean, it is, I guess in terms of those four goals, I guess I kind of view the, you know, kind of ratcheting it down as kind of embedded in there. But it is partly why in Oregon, you know, the discussion needs to be on both of the reform strategies. Not just limits, but also, you know, the public financing angle. So in terms of the other states, again, I can get back to you with there, but I think that there is evidence that it just starts to kind of, you know, put kind of a keeps the brake on things, because it's the only way to get people to agree to a spending cap. And clearly in the Portland analysis, that reduced spending has been one of the goals clearly that has surfaced there, with, you know, a marked contrast. I mean, the last election cycle involved an open seat race. The analogous race prior to the adoption of the Portland program was in 2004, and that open seat race involved records fundraising between 500 and 600,000 by, you know, both candidates. And the open seat race, you know, people were spending, you know, public funding allocation, 150,000. I mean, if anything, there's conversation in Portland, like, is this enough money to run a viable race? So that's the other, so yes, we start to see that kind of evidence. But it is important to recognize that the other element of public financing is not just how much money, and I think it is really, really important for a viable public funding program to give enough money. I mean, you know, this is, you do need to get a message out. So the other, you know, dynamic is just the source of money. But yeah, I think we are starting to see how it puts the brakes on things.
And you gave us a pretty good list of states that have public funding, but you didn't give us a list of states that limit contributions in some way.
Almost all.
So Oregon is way in the minority in that.
Yeah. Something. Yeah, I mean, I actually just haven't had it. I mean, I say it's in the ballpark of five. I think that might include a couple of states that maybe have like one or two limits. You know, Dan may have more up-to-date information, you know, but it's five or less. And, you know, maybe in a couple of those five, there might be one or two limits, but not, you know. So Oregon is very much the exception rather than the rule. One indication of that, and, you know, as I've talked with, you know, lawyers to take a look at things and help me with feedback from the Brennan Center, one part of the conversation is usually, oh, yeah, and you're from Oregon. You're one of those, you know, it's like you're one of those exceptions without rules, and that has to shift, you know, their feedback.
And finally, and this may have been more of a question I should have asked Gina, but I know that in her description of the way the Oregon Supreme Court threw out Measure 9, apparently they did not find that there was a compelling public interest or a specific harm or whatever that would have justified limiting contributions. But now, you know, the Senate Bill 10, the ethics law, is being challenged on the same basis as being an unconstitutional limitation on freedom of speech under Article 1, Section 8. And so far, the lower court has rejected that challenge, saying the legislature had a legitimate purpose in putting some limits on contributions, or I guess that's not the term, but on gifts. So I wonder whether there, I mean, obviously everybody has kind of accepted for now that we're going to have to amend the Oregon Constitution if we want to limit campaign contributions, but I'm wondering if you think there's been any shifting of analysis, or if you think we're still in the same position that we were back in 1995 or whenever that was.
Well, as a non-lawyer, I hesitate to say anything, but...
Oh, you know, we do that all the time here,
okay.
So...
So one element, I mean, I think in terms of the, and Gina could really speak to this if I, well, can come up and correct me if I'm wrong, but, I mean, in my layperson's sense of trying to get my mind around, you know, the difference between the federal First Amendment and the free speech protections in the Oregon Constitution is that there is more allowance at the federal First Amendment for this balancing test, and that there just isn't that kind of balancing test allowance, I think is one way to describe the free speech provisions in the Oregon Constitution. And that, you know, Gina might say I'm a little bit off, but hopefully I'm kind of in the ballpark. So I think that's how I've at least described it, and I have talked with others in legislative council to help kind of me figure out how to talk about that. So I think I'm in the ballpark there. And I have had people tell me that they think, you know, the current Oregon Supreme Court or some subsequent Oregon Supreme Court might have, you know, made a different decision. I mean, who knows? But certainly it does seem, you know, to be the conventional wisdom that you do need to amend the Constitution. And I mean, I think you could have legislative council give you a whole nother, you could have a whole nother conversation about that lowercase decision related to the gift limits, because I think there's some other angles coming up in that case that are in addition to the free speech provisions, and that's so.
Thanks, Diane. Thank you. Any other questions? All right. Mr. Meek, come on up. And I'm guessing he'll be, he's bite, chomping at the bit to also respond to your question, Chair Rosenbaum. Did you want to invite up Mr. Lonsdale with you?
Sure.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And I think that's why I asked the question of Gina earlier, was like there's wiggle room under the federal constitution, but there doesn't, at least at this point in time, appear to be any wiggle room under the Oregon Constitution. So, but I suspect Mr. Meek may have another perspective on that.
Good afternoon. My name is Dan Meek. I was a volunteer supporting measures 46 and 47 of 2006, one of which passed and one of which did not. Harry Lonsdale, of course, ran for the U.S. Senate from Oregon three times, and he was another of the volunteers in that effort. And I have handed out both to the audience and to the members of the committee five handouts, most of which I probably won't refer to, but I would like to zip through a few of the slides. One of the handouts is a little compilation of slides, most of which I won't mention. In response to the presentation of history this morning, I think actually the first statute involved with political campaign contributions and expenditures in Oregon was enacted only 5 years after the Oregon Constitution was adopted. In 1864, a bill was passed called the Crimes Against the Crimes Against Public Justice Act, which actually required disclosure of lobbying expenses and also had limitations on what you could do with your campaign money. For example, you could not use it to persuade someone not to vote. Back in the 1800s, the main concern seemed to be political candidates bribing voters and not the other way around. Strangely enough, we've come 180 degrees on that, I think. Also in 1908, Oregon voters enacted a ballot measure to its rather strictly limited political contributions and expenditures, the ballot title. Now, just imagine this ballot title on the ballot today in Oregon. A bill for a law to limit the amount of money candidates and other persons may contribute or spend in election campaigns, to prohibit and punish the corrupting use of money and undue influence in elections, and to protect the purity of the ballot. Strangely enough, we were not able to get those kind of favorable ballot titles for both Measure 46 and 47. We were stuck with, in fact, on 46, we were stuck with a ballot title that actually had a typographical error inserted by the Attorney General's office at the last minute, which we could not remove without challenging our own ballot title in the Supreme Court and potentially not making the ballot because it would have added another, you know, undetermined amount of time to actually getting a final ballot title and being able to collect signatures.
I think we either passed or tried to pass a bill to change that, though.
But you did not.
We did not pass it.
Madam
Chair,
must
have been in another bill then that somebody didn't like.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So that law that was passed by voters in 1908 was in effect through 1973 when the Oregon legislature repealed it and substituted a different law limiting overall candidate expenditures, which then the Oregon Supreme Court struck down in 1975. And the Buckley decision in 1976 basically said that you can't limit overall candidate expenditures, although you can limit independent expenditures. McCain-Feingold Act bans all independent expenditures by corporations, all of them by unions and other entities, basically allows independent expenditures by some entities and by individuals. In 1994, of course, Measure 9 passed, and you've heard about that, but also what you didn't hear about was Measure 6 of 1994, which amended the Oregon Constitution to ban all corporate contributions, to ban all union contributions, and to allow only individuals to make contributions to political campaigns in Oregon, and only individuals who reside in the district of the district of the office for which they're making the contribution. Now, the out-of-district part of that was found to be unconstitutional by the federal courts. But that amendment is still in the Oregon Constitution, and that's also relevant to whether Measure 47 is going to be upheld. Because the federal courts can't take anything out of the Oregon Constitution. They can tell you that enforcing certain things is going to be unconstitutional under the federal Constitution, but they can't amend or take anything out of the Oregon Constitution. And then finally in 2006, of course, Measure 46, the constitutional amendment, did not pass, but Measure 47, the statute limiting contributions, did pass. So we've gone through the history already. I think that Janice's presentation was excellent, but didn't quite highlight the top heaviness of the contributions, political contributions in Oregon. And this slide indicates that in 1996, when those limits were, the Measure 9 limits were in effect, total spending on Oregon candidate campaigns was $4.2 million, and that includes independent expenditures. In 2002, that went up to $42 million, and in 2006, it went up to $49 million. So that's about a factor of 12 increase in a period of one decade. In the last election, the two candidates for governor in the general, who made it to the general, collectively spent over $15 million. All candidates together spent $18 million for governor. Some individual contributions from entities and individual persons were rather stunning. Ron Saxon got $2.1 million from the Republican Governors Association, funded by whom we don't know, and also millions of dollars from individual corporate executives. The Wentz gave, Rod Wendt gave $375,000 to Saxton. Some real estate folks gave $600,000 to Saxton. Bill Swindells gave $250,000 to Saxton. Lauren Parks gave $713,000 to Mannix, and that's all just in the governor's race. Governor Kulongoski, of course, received a large amount of money from unions, at least $1.5 million that I can trace, plus the unions ran a $700,000 independent expenditure campaign for him. So the amount of money in Oregon races is really pretty stunning. If you look at how much legislative races cost now, state Senate races, and this is in sort of reverse chronological order, so you start at the bottom. In 2002, six Senate races, there were six races in which a Senate candidate spent $500,000 or more. It then went up in 2004. It did go down in 2006. And the reason for that really is that Senate races are becoming less competitive. For example, in this election cycle, eight of the 15 races are not contested by two major parties. So it's hard to have a big spending race when you don't have a race at all. So in this election cycle, it's hard to say how many of the contested races will again exceed $500,000 each. In state house races, the number of folks who have been spending more than $250,000 has increased from 10 in 2002, 11 in 2004, to 18 in 2006. So I think the trajectory is pretty obvious. This is basically the current Oregon political money system. You start at the top with the big box that says corporations, unions, entities, groups, and individuals of any age. And there's no limit on contributions whatsoever from them or from, if you look over on the right-hand side, the candidate, any candidate. Also, U means unlimited contribution. So this just sort of describes the entities that exist in Oregon political funding law. And, of course, you'll notice that all of the lines are thick lines, and all of them say U, which means unlimited. There are utterly no limits whatsoever. And the contrast to that, I'll just skip down to the description of Measure 47, which was enacted and is currently Secretary of State and Attorney General are declining to enforce it, but we are suing them and are currently in the Court of Appeals to get the courts to compel them to enforce it. This was Measure 47. And you can see that the only contributions in Measure 47 and the source of all funds is individual U.S. citizens, period, nothing else. And each individual can contribute in the aggregate per year only $2,500 to these various entities, plus, if you look over on the far left-hand side, $10,000 a year on independent expenditures. Really, the key number in the chart is the $2,500 aggregate limit on contributions by any individual. There are several states that do have these sorts of limits. Let me find a little table here. This indicates existing states that have similar limits on aggregate contributions by individual. It's as low as Arizona, $3,230 per year. District of Columbia, $8,500. There are several that are in the range of $10,000 to $12,000. New York is $150,000, but even that's, of course, better than Oregon, where we have folks who are contributing, individuals who are contributing five times that amount to individual campaigns. Under the Measure 47 system, any individual can contribute to any candidate, if you look over on the right candidate committee, $500 or $100 per election period. The $500 is for statewide races, like governor, secretary of state, etc. The $100 is for all non-statewide races, whether they're legislature or state and local races. The individual can also contribute up to $2,000 a year to a political party, $500 a year to any number of political committees, $50 a year to any number of small donor committees, and the membership organization box on the left of that simply indicates that a small donor committee can be created by a membership organization, and the membership organization can pass through part of its dues to the small donor committee. A membership organization can be a union. It can also be the National Rifle Association, the Sierra Club, or any other organization that qualifies as having members. An individual can also, on the far left, contribute $10,000 a year in independent expenditures. As Janice indicated, that's probably the part of the measure that is most subject to challenge under the U.S. Constitution. And therefore, we have some backstops down here. And that is, if independent expenditures are made, every advertisement funded by such independent expenditures have to disclose the top five funding sources as long as each one of them is $500 or more. And there are very detailed disclosures are required in the ad. It has to state the name of the person or entity, the businesses that the person or entity is engaged in, the amount of money the person or entity has contributed for this campaign. So very extensive disclosures of independent expenditures where they're allowed. And if the $10,000 a year limit on individuals is struck down, those disclosure requirements still apply. So I think the effectiveness of independent expenditures may be placed into jeopardy by this because of the very extensive disclosure requirements that have to come with every advertisement. And that's probably all I would say about the details of Measure 47, except that it does have If you'll notice up on the top right-hand corner, it does limit what a candidate can spend on his or her own race to $50,000 in a statewide race or $10,000 in a non-statewide race. That also may be subject to question under the U.S. Constitution, particularly in light of the Davis versus FEC decision that came out earlier this year. And the slides also indicate other things, that other features of Measure 47. There are some additional features. It doesn't allow any political committee to contribute to another political committee. It doesn't allow a candidate or committee to retain funds at the end of the, or a candidate committee to retain funds at the end of the election cycle. Those funds must be paid to the state, except that a candidate for the legislature who wins can, I think, use up to $10,000 of those funds for office expenses, that sort of thing. As I mentioned, we are in court, in the Court of Appeals, on getting Measure 47 enforced. And, of course, the main argument is going to be that it's not allowed under the same, for the same reasons that Measure 9 of 1994 isn't allowed. But we've come up with, we have extensive briefs. They're all available at the website fairelections.net/court. And so we've come up with at least two dozen good reasons that Measure 47 is different from Measure 9 and why the Supreme Court should uphold Measure 47. Of the justices who decided the issue back in 1997 on Measure 9, two of them do remain at the court, Justice Gillette and Justice Durham. The rest are new. Who knows whether we would win or lose in the court, but I do think there is a realistic chance that we would win in the Supreme Court. On the subject of public funding, I would only add maybe one or two things to the very good presentation by Janice, and that is, unfortunately, Federal District Court in Arizona on August 29th struck down the provision of the public funding law in Arizona that provides for additional matching funds depending upon the amount that is spent by the opponent. That will be particularly, of course, it's just the Federal District Court decision, and Federal District Court decisions are often overturned either by the Circuit Courts or by the Supreme Court. So it's not all that important, I would say. But if it were applied in Oregon, it would be very important in a regime of no limits. By the way, Oregon is, I think I would agree with Janice, that a realistic way of stating it is that Oregon is one of five states with no limits. Technically, it's one of three states with no limits. They are Oregon, New Mexico, and Missouri now. Missouri had limits adopted by initiative, which were in effect for about 10 years, and then the legislature last year repealed them all. I hope there's some repercussion for that. Let's see. But there also, Utah essentially has no limits and only has some limits on insurance companies. Illinois has only limits on what judicial candidates and their families can contribute, so that's essentially no limits at all. So I would say there's five. Virginia comes fairly close to having no limits. They do have limits on paramutual horse racing corporations. So probably six is a realistic number to say have really no limits. But in a regime of no limits, the opponent is able to raise and spend a lot more money. Back now in Arizona, they have rather strict limits. So it's difficult for the privately funded candidate, the candidate who opts out of public funding, to raise as much money as they could in Oregon. In Oregon, you can call up Lauren Parks and get $750,000 in some cases. So if the public funding regime cannot adjust the amount of public funding available to the candidates who sign up based upon the privately funded candidates' expenditures, then I think it will be the public funding regime in Oregon will be overwhelmed by the private candidates.
Thank you. Mr. Lonsdale, anything else?
Could I?
Sure.
Thanks. First, my name is Harry Lonsdale. I'm a private citizen from Sisters, Oregon. And if you'll allow me to violate protocol for just a second, I want to say hello to Kate, Diane, and Peter. Haven't seen you in a long time. And to those of you I don't know, I say hello now. Thanks for having me. And thanks for giving me a couple of minutes. I only want to take probably no more than 2 or 3 minutes to emphasize some things that you've already heard, perhaps some things that you haven't already heard. First, Oregon is one of 3, 5, or 6 states with no limits whatsoever on campaign contributions. Anybody, any entity from any country can you contribute unlimited amounts of money to anybody running for any office in Oregon. It's unheard of in most countries, but quite the fact here in Oregon. Secondly, corporations have been prohibited from making contributions to federal candidates since Teddy Roosevelt was president, before anyone in this room was born. No corporate contributions to federal candidates. Third, unions have been prohibited from making contributions to federal candidates since Harry Truman was president, more than 50 years. No limits here in Oregon, as you know. Fourth, twice, Oregon voters, by initiative, have said they want limits on campaign contributions. First in 1994, struck down by the court, as you just heard, and most recently in 2006, not struck down by the court, but unfortunately not being enforced by either the Secretary of State or the Attorney General. Those are the facts. There's still no law in Oregon for limiting in any way campaign contributions. And when I introduce myself as a private citizen, you might call me an angry private citizen. Why don't votes have an effect? We voted for these things twice, and still there's no limits. It seems to me the solution is something Dan's already suggested, that is for you, the legislature, to amend the Constitution to make it clear that money is not free speech in our state. Right now it appears that the Supreme Court does deem Article 1, Section 8 of our Constitution as saying money is free speech. It is not. Supreme Court Justice John Paul Stevens made it very clear just a few years ago. He says money is property. It is not free speech. And I couldn't agree with him more on that issue. So I ask you to consider initiating a step to amend the Constitution in Oregon to make it clear that money is not free speech and that we can put limits on campaign contributions in our state. We've done it federally for more than 100 years, and the country still survives. We can survive here in Oregon as well. Thank you for allowing me that time.
Thank you, and we appreciate your passionate testimony. Two questions, one question for both of you, and that is, what kind of goals do you want campaign finance reform to achieve? And I look at the federal system. We've had limits in effect for a long period of time. I look at the makeup of the Senate. No offense. It's pretty white. It's pretty male. Congress, frankly, is not much better. I think the percentage of women is is pretty grim. Also in terms of people of color. So we have limits in effect at the federal level. At least from my perspective, it hasn't diversified who's representing us in Congress and the U.S. Senate. So I guess my question for both of you is, what kind of goals do you see a campaign finance reform system achieving? What do you want to achieve by campaign finance reform?
I would just address one point, if I could, Kate. That is, ask Janet Napolitano in Arizona who won under the system. And I think she said repeatedly in Arizona, I do smell my winners in Arizona, by the way, that without the system, she would never have been elected as governor of Arizona. So it would certainly help the point you just made about diversity. But I'll let Dan continue.
My concern is the effect on policy. And in the slides, I indicate several policies I think are directly affected by campaign contributions. Lottery commissions for one thing, the Oregon tax system for another thing. I mean, is it really a coincidence that Oregon has among the highest income taxes on folks who are living at or near the poverty line of any state in America, while at the same time it has among the lowest taxes on corporations of any state in America? I think that's not an accident. And I think I've indicated in the slides many other examples of where it's not an accident. And from my experience, you probably all know that in real life, I sue utilities for cheating ratepayers and get involved in utility rate cases at the PUC. Always in the back of everyone's mind is, no matter what gets accomplished there, the utilities can come over to the legislature and probably get what they want. And that certainly has something to do with the fact that the utilities contribute millions of dollars to candidates over the years, as do drug companies, as do basically all large corporate sectors in Oregon. My other concern is that I don't want money selecting office holders, and I think it does. I don't think necessarily contributions influence office holders, but they do select office holders. That is, you've got to have a source of funds in order to run a credible campaign, in order to get elected in the first place. I think money selects the folks who run and win, and those folks are perfectly agreeable to the agenda that their contributors set.
So, Dan, let me stop you right there. And I've really struggled with this one in terms of
I think what you said, we don't want money selecting office holders. And I'm not quite clear that if we put limits on contributions, how that doesn't make it more difficult for people who have less access to money to raise the dollars they need to run for campaigns. Because you simply need more people with fewer amounts of money.
Senator Brown, currently, if you don't have access to large amounts of money and large contributors, then your voice is drowned out. If everyone is limited, that is, if there are no corporate contributions, no union contributions, and everyone has to, for in legislative races, for example, would have to depend upon individual contributions in the amount of $100 or less, you wouldn't have million-dollar campaigns for the House that drown out the other, that drown out the opposing candidates.
Except for the millionaire exception. You could still have millionaire.
Well, Measure 47 does not have a millionaire's exception.
Okay.
Measure 47.
We still have a we probably have a federal hurdle there, I'm guessing. So
Measure 47 for a legislative candidate does allow the legislative candidate to contribute $10,000 to her own campaign.
Okay.
One other thing I would add to what Harry said, Oregon voters have actually enacted limits on contributions and expenditures four times. 1908, twice in 1994, and in 2006.
I would just add to what Dan said about millionaires and so on. I very much agree with what Janice Thompson says. We do need publicly funded elections, I think, all across the country. We don't have it. We voted it down here in Oregon, I think, in 2002, rather substantially. In California, they clobbered it in 2006. I think it lost 75-25. So it's still a long way to go to get but that's the point we need to reach.
So I think, Harry, what you would say, and maybe I should ask the question, would you say that public financing or there need to be additional solutions in addition to campaign finance limits in order to make substantial changes to our political system?
I would agree. But,
okay.
Kate, it's been 100 years, and we haven't even made the first crucial step yet. In 100 years, it's a long time.
I hear you. Okay. Sarah Farioli.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The observation I'd make is maybe folks don't necessarily agree. But I was looking at this flowchart, and it's under the small donor committee. It says anyone can create one. Mm-hmm. Can a union create one?
Yes, Senator Farioli.
Can a union make a contribution on a per-member basis to a small donor committee?
In essence, yes. That is, if the individual dues, the union can allocate a part of individual dues to the small donor committee as long as it's not more than $50 per member per year.
Mm-hmm. And then, following the flowchart, is there any limit on the small donor committee expenditure for a candidate?
No, there is not. That is the thick lines.
Through that series of loopholes. Thank you.
Well, I don't consider it a loophole. I consider any organization which attracts contributions only in amounts of $50 or less per person. I don't see a reason for limiting what that organization, how that organization can use the funds.
Sure.
I would agree that if the contribution is voluntary, you have a point. But if a union can contribute on a per-member basis without necessarily getting the permission from the member, then I would say what you have is a cash machine. You have a $50 ATM times the membership times the annual. It's a great racket.
Senator Farioli, I would. I only wish the unions had agreed with you and had not spent $800,000 to defeat this measure, which they did. Every union opposed this measure.
I've known Mr. Meek for quite a while. He sometimes doesn't recognize when I'm being facetious. Look, what I see here is a mechanism for unions to continue to make large cash contributions on a per capita basis, and all I have to do is $50 a year times every member. Whether or not the union folks like that or don't like that individually, we see that argument going on with some folks refusing to make the PAC contributions, but they do that at their own peril. So I would just say that there is a, if you are intending to take organizational donations out of the system, I don't see that you've achieved that with the flowchart that you created here.
It's restricted.
The other one, Madam Chairman.
Sarah Farioli.
Is there any limit to the amount that the SDC can contribute to the candidate?
Senator Farioli, I did not hear the question.
The small donor committee, there's no limit apparently on how much the small donor committee can contribute to an individual candidate.
Correct.
So it's just it's only limited by the amount of number of members times $50 they can compel.
Yes.
And then it also looks like the small donor committee can make contributions to a political committee. Is there any limit on independent expenditures?
The small donor committee, is the on this chart, the legend in the lower left-hand corner states thick line equals unlimited. So wherever you see a thick line with an arrow on the end, that is an unlimited path.
So if I had a union or an organization with 10,000 members times $50 per year, there's no limit on the political party contribution or the independent expenditure or the candidate committee.
That's true. However, a small donor committee, if it contributed to a political party, that's true. If it contributed to a political party, there are limits on what a political party under Measure 47 can contribute to a candidate committee, but they are technical, and in effect, a party can contribute as much as it wants to a candidate committee. There are technically limits, but they're not mean. I think they are not ultimately meaningful. So your statement is correct.
I don't see this as a level playing field, but perhaps that is not.
Thank you, Senator Farrielly. Apparently, Oregonians agreed with you, at least at the constitutional level. Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dan, could you, on the constitutional level, I'm trying to understand, you mentioned that the second measure that was passed in 94 did ban corporate and union contributions, but then the feds said that there was the part of it, the contributions from out of district, you couldn't limit those. Mm-hmm. Why can't we, so that we still then cannot ban corporate and union unless we pass another measure to do so, or unless we change the Constitution?
Well, Representative Buckley, one of our arguments in the Court of Appeals is that Measure 47's ban on corporate and union contributions is constitutional because that ban is already in the constitutions. Whether the court accepts that, we'll have to wait and see.
I wasn't aware of that. Thank you.
Anything further, Representative Buckley?
No, thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I wanted to just say something and then ask you a question. I do think it's important, and I know, you know, this obviously you may think or some may think that people who run for office under the current system are inherently held hostage by a system that requires raising of private money, but I do think to some extent it is insulting to elected officials who actually agree with you about the need to change the system or who may not agree with you, because there really are remarkable things that have been achieved in Oregon recently and over time by legislators who have, working together with advocates, gotten some pretty cutting-edge public policy enacted into law. So I just wanted to say that, and you don't have to respond to that. But I did want to ask for either of you, Dan, you mentioned that your goal is to achieve good public policy, and I think probably everybody who runs for office thinks their goal is to achieve good public policy too. But things like the tax system being very, very difficult to change in Oregon, and having such a low tax burden on low-income people, a high tax burden on low-income people, and a low tax burden on corporations, I think is a result perhaps more of the initiative process and the 3/5 requirement for revenue bills now being in the Oregon Constitution. And so I know you've done a lot of work in the initiative process, obviously, both of you. I'm just curious whether you think that these policy changes really are going to require also some kind of limits being applied to the kind of money that gets spent on initiatives, because obviously we've had a lot of initiatives or referenda where the legislature's actually done something, and in the case of tax measures, it usually ends up on the ballot whether the legislature could ever get to 3/5 to enact it or not, whether you think we also need some ability to make some changes in that area. And I'm not clear whether your measures actually do apply potentially to setting some limitations in the initiative arena, do they? the ones you filed for next cycle?
Chair Rosenbaum, that's sort of several questions.
I'm not a lawyer, so that's okay. Why I get to do that.
On the effect of the 46 and 47 on ballot measures, of course, 46 didn't pass, so that's not relevant. 47 doesn't apply to ballot measures. One of the handouts is entitled Measures We Have Proposed for 2010. These are six versions that we have ballot titles for. And each of these, some of these would remove any impediment in the Oregon Constitution to limiting contributions and expenditures for or against ballot measures. However, that's probably irrelevant because the U.S. Supreme Court has never upheld a limit on contributions or expenditures on ballot measures. It struck them down in Massachusetts in 1978, in California in 1982, in the Ninth Circuit when Montana enacted limits about 10 years ago. The Ninth Circuit struck those down. I believe that was either denied cert or not appealed. So our constitutional amendments generally would allow, under the Oregon Constitution, limits on ballot measure contributions and expenditures, but unless the Supreme Court's doctrine changes, that doesn't matter because the Supreme Court has said such limits aren't allowed under the First Amendment. Of course, the initiative process is a whole other subject, and the purpose of these measures, of our measures to limit contributions to political candidates, is basically to establish elected officials and elected bodies that will pursue good public policy aims so that the folks don't have to rely on the initiative process to do that. Of course, it's a constant struggle to keep the initiative process open for grassroots measures. For example, in the year 2000, there were 9, what I call, progressive measures on the Oregon statewide ballot. This year there are 0. There has been a constant progression downward because basically the cost of getting a measure on the ballot, whether you use paid circulators or volunteers, has increased by at least a factor of 4 in the last 8 years. That means that grassroots organizations are progressively shut out of the initiative process, but folks who've got the money, as is illustrated by nearly every measure on this year's ballot, aren't shut out. So we end up with a ballot that has all what I would consider, all except maybe one, very, you know, conservative or right-wing measures on the ballot, no progressive measures on the ballot. So if we had limits on campaign contributions for candidates for public office, it would, I think, be less necessary for folks to use the initiative process. But I know that there will be people who disagree with that.
Okay. Thank you, Sarah Ferriello. A brief comment, and then we need to move along.
Thank you, ma'am.
I'm going to let him speak, and then I'll.
Two issues to set the record straight, if I might, please. First of all, according to ORS 260. Foreign nationals are prohibited by federal law from making contributions to influence any candidate election. Thus, candidate committees, miscellaneous committees, and political party committees may not accept contributions from a foreign national, including individuals with foreign citizenship, immigrants not possessing a green card, foreign governments, foreign political parties, foreign corporations, or foreign associations and foreign partnerships. And this is in the Oregon Election Manual. So I'm hoping that nobody is misled into believing, as a result of our hearing today, that they can, in fact, take funding from foreign nationals. They can't. The other thing is, Madam Chair, we do not have to change the Constitution to realign Oregon's tax tables. So if we believe that we are taxing poor people too much, we can double the deductibility. That is to say, instead of charging people at $2,901, the 5% tax rate, we could actually double that deduction to $6,000. It might cost us about $361 million, but it will create 19,000 new jobs in the state of Oregon. And I'll look forward to the help of all the members of this committee to get that bill passed in the next legislative session. Thank you.
Senator Farioli, I look forward to watching the legislature have that discussion next time around. So, Mr. Lonsdale, Mr. Meek, I'm going to put Harry on first and then Nan. And then we got to wrap it. We got to move along.
Forgive me for using first names, but Diane, I just want to comment to what you said. I agree. The legislature has done some great stuff. I ask you to fix this problem of money in politics is my rejoinder to your comment. And Ted, whom I don't even know, forgive me again for using your first name, but I would say this about the first point you made about unions being able to game the system. You're right. I agree with your point. All I can say is AOI or the Oregon Restaurant Association or any other organization can start all the small donor committees it wants to and abide by the same rules. But I do agree with your point.
Hmm. Yeah.
And all that I would say, Senator Farioli, is there's one exception, and that is any candidate in Oregon can accept an unlimited amount of money from foreign subsidiaries of U.S. corporations.
All right. Thank you both very much.
Thank you very much.
I look forward to having the petition 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, and 12 conversation later. I know that we have folks from the ACLU here in the room, and we're not going to have time, I think, to call her up today. But it looks like it would be a very interesting conversation. I appreciate the information. Next up, I see Representative Greenlick is here. I'd like to roll. I know we have some guests here on the National Popular Vote. It is our courtesy to bring up legislative members, and Representative Greenlick is here. I'd like you to come up, Representative Greenlick, and talk a little bit about House Bill 3270, and I'm guessing you want Mr. Lindback to come up with you.
Yes.
Okay.
To ride shotgun.
To ride shotgun. All right. And we're going to take a minute here to bring up Mr. Norton from the Brennan Center for Justice, New York University School of Law. So if everybody can just be at ease for a few minutes.
Mr. Norton, are you online?
Oh,
I'm here, yes.
Oh, great. Okay, fabulous. All right. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm going to put Representative Greenlick and Mr. Lindback on first, and thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do I have two Madam Chairs today? Is that right?
Yes. For the price of one.
Yeah. Before she deserts us and goes somewhere else. I'm very happy to be here to talk about House Bill 3270. Is that right? I think it's the right number. I have trouble remembering even my own bill numbers nowadays. This bill came about because a group of citizens were concerned about assuring the validity of the Oregon election process. And I worked with a group of folks for several months before the session started and then again into the process of the session to try and create a process that would assure Oregon voters of the validity, assure Oregon voters that their vote that had been cast was in fact counted and counted correctly. We had all sorts of discussions on it, but what I think I had is two guiding principles that underlaid the development of the bill as I helped develop and as Mr. Lindbeck worked on its development were two things. One is I believed in the integrity of the Oregon election system. I didn't start with an assumption that there was something wrong and that it needed to be fixed. For example, any time that a hand-tallied recount had been done in the state and it was shown again this spring, the outcomes of the hand tally were essentially identical with the mechanical counting of the ballots. The second thing I believe that was very important is that we were fortunate in Oregon, so we didn't have to be quite as paranoid because we had paper ballots that we could always go back to and count by hand. But the third thing that was on my mind is that hand tallies aren't always correct and that there are errors in hand tallies as well as errors in mechanical tallies. The next thing that I had on my mind was the old principle that the perfect can be the enemy of the good. While there were proposals for systems that might be statistically perfect, and I'm a professionally trained statistician, and an ex-member, at least, of the American Statistical Society. I wanted, in this case, to create a feasible option for how to assure Oregonians that their ballots were actually being counted. As we all know in the legislature, good policy is a combination of good substance and good politics, and we needed to create, I believed, a feasible model. The last consideration that was on our mind as we considered this is that there looked like it loomed on the horizon federal legislation that would affect ballots, that how we could assure the validity of the voting system, and the model that eventually became implemented in proposed in 3270 was consistent with what was being considered in the U.S. Congress at the time for this situation. So we had all these considerations. We created 3270 and left a lot of room for rulemaking to implement it. And I think a lot of the things we're going to talk about today, I hope, is how to improve the process as a part of the rulemaking process without essentially throwing the basic concept we have in the wastebasket. I think we have a concept that's feasible, practical, and affordable, and that should assure Oregon citizens that their votes are, in fact, being tallied as they're intended to be.
Thank you. John?
Thank you, Mayor. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm John Lindbeck. I'm Director of Elections in the Secretary of State's office. The first thing that I should point out to you is that this bill adds a second layer of testing to one layer that already exists. The counties are already required to perform public logic and accuracy tests, also known as LNA tests in our world, on tally machines used to count votes in each Oregon election. LNA tests involve running a test deck of ballots through a machine to verify that it correctly counts votes. And under Oregon law, those LNA tests are conducted once, no later than 5 days before the election. And again, this is in public. Again, on election day, before the county actually begins counting the real ballots. And again, once all the ballots are counted and reconciled, but before the final results of the election are certified to the state. So House Bill 3270 adds a second layer of testing in response to a public interest in additional assurances that our ballots are counted correctly. And it requires a random selection of races to be recounted by hand from a random selection of precincts or batches of ballots in each county. The bill requires this test only for general elections. On the day after the general election, the Secretary of State will advise the county clerk, each county clerk in writing, which election contests and the precincts or batches to be hand-counted. The contest subject to the hand recount must include the contest in your county between the two candidates receiving the largest number of votes. Presumably this year, we would assume that will be the presidential race. And then they must also hand count a contest for a state office and a contest for a state measure if possible. And I don't remember a general election ballot that didn't have state measures on it. So I think this is going to be pretty consistent from now into the future. The number of precincts to be hand-counted depends on the margin between the two candidates in the race that receive the most votes in the county. And so if the margin of victory between those two candidates, and let's presume this year it'll be the presidential candidates in each county, is 2% or greater, then 3% of the precincts or batches must be recounted by hand. If it's between 1% and 2%, then 5% of the precincts or batches of ballots must be recounted by hand. And if it's between 0 and 1%, then 10% of the precincts or batches must be recounted by hand. So the closer that big race is in your county, the more ballots will be hand recounted in that particular county. The counties are required to conduct the hand counts using the current statutes, which include a requirement that recounts are to be done in public and that can be observed. Those recounts can begin immediately after the county submits its initial certification of the election to the Secretary of State, which must occur no later than 20 days after the election. And the process must be complete by the 30th day after the election, which is the day the Secretary of State certifies the election. Once the initial hand count is completed, the results are compared with those from the vote tally system. If the outcome of the hand count differs by less than 0.5% from the vote tally system, the vote tally system's count remains the official tally, and the process is over. If the outcome of the hand count is greater than 0.5%, a second hand count must be conducted, and the process is repeated. One thing that's very important here to keep in mind, in the typical recount that you see with an optical scan system, and we saw it with the Measure 53 recount that we just conducted after the last election, you always end up with more votes. Why is that? Well, the reason for that is because machines sometimes can't read the votes if the voter doesn't mark the ballot correctly. But in a recount situation, an election board is able to read that vote and determine the intent of the voter. And so that's the value of a hand recount, is that you will pick up those few votes that the machines were unable to read because the voter might have been very infirm in the way that they were able to mark the ballot, or they marked it slightly outside the oval or the box. And those situations do not count in that 0.5%, because that's not an issue. Those are not an issue where the machine tallied incorrectly, or that there was something wrong with the inside of the machine and the way it functioned. It simply could not read the ballot because the voter marked the ballot incorrectly. If the results of that second hand count show a difference greater than 0.5%, then the county must hand count all races on each ballot in the county. It means something is seriously wrong with the machine. You would want to check on the integrity of your vote count, and you would thus want to recount everything. Two parts of this law need fixing in the future legislature. The 10-day period is not sufficient if a county must recount every race on every ballot.
That's okay. 30. John, would you move that to 30 then? 30 days?
What I would do is I would move, in the eventuality of that, I would move that after state certification, which is normally when we do full recounts now.
Okay.
The second fix is, if the county is already subject to a countywide recount, they should not be required to do this recount as well.
Okay.
And right now, they are vulnerable to that they might have a recount in a sheriff's race, for example, which is countywide, and they'll be doing that and this. And that seems unnecessary. The Secretary of State has proposed rules, as Representative Greenlick has mentioned, to assist with the implementation. One of the provisions in the rules that we've proposed is to establish an advisory committee to handle those random selections of the races and the precincts and batches in each county. The rules also prescribe a form that the counties must fill out when reporting results of the recounts. We've received comments from two groups on the rules, and we had a public hearing on them this morning and received additional feedback. It's been excellent feedback. We do expect to make some changes to our rules and bolster them and improve them as a result of the feedback we've received so far. And that's my report. I'll stop there, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Before we take any questions, I'd like to give Mr. Larry Norden from the Brennan Center an opportunity to comment. And we really appreciate you being here by phone today. Are you still there?
Thanks very much. I was on mute. Thanks, Madam Chair, and thanks to the committees for inviting me to speak. I did send over. I don't know if it got to all of you a report that the Brennan Center worked on. It was kind of an overview of both academic literature and state practices on post-election audits. This is a comprehensive report that we put together last year.
And we do have it, just so you know. I anticipate that my colleagues haven't been able to read it yet, but we'll be expecting them to read it, and there'll be a quiz in our October meeting.
Okay,
so,
well, so, you know, I was asked, one of the things I was asked when I talked to committee staff was to talk about how this bill compares to what other states are doing. So I'm happy to do that. I'll try to be brief. I have basically three overarching messages that I'd like to provide. One is, first is a congratulations to the Oregon State Legislature and to Representative Greenlook for this for passing this bill. Only 18 states conduct what 3270 refers to as post-election hand counts, and in general among election integrity activists are called post-election audits of paper records, and it's certainly something that the Brennan Center and many other election administration experts think is a critical component for increasing voting system security and reliability, and generally improving election administration. So that's my first main point that I don't want to be lost in whatever else I discuss. The second and third points are somewhat related, and that has to do with the fact that, you know, this is a relatively, post-election audits are a relatively new phenomena. Although your neighbor California has been doing them for a long time, there hasn't necessarily been a lot of thinking about them up until the point where we had this kind of massive transformation in the country to electronic voting and the rise of the election integrity movement. There has been a lot of new thinking about conducting post-election audits, not just among activists and academics, but in various states around the country. A lot of states are now, including California, considering ways to refine their post-election audit processes. I think as you conduct post-election audits in Oregon, I'm sure you'll learn a lot, and I hope that the legislature is open to refining the law based on things that are learned. And as I said, the third related point is something that I think would be beneficial, and I don't know to what extent it can be done under Oregon law without a change in the law, but that I think might be beneficial in terms of learning about how to improve audits would be to allow pilots of audits, different kinds of audits. That's something that's been done. We helped some counties in Ohio do in the last set of primaries. It's something that it has been done, and I'll talk a little bit more about this in California as they're thinking about making, and Secretary Bowen is just thinking about making changes to the current audit law in California. So quickly, I'll provide some points of comparison that I think are interesting for this bill compared to other things that are done in other states. Before I do that, I want to just briefly go over what I think are, and we talk about this in a little bit in our study, what I think are the main reasons for conducting audits in the first place. Part of the reason that people who start arguing over what's a better practice for audits, and often people talk past each other, is because they're looking at different goals for the audits. Representative Greenlook mentioned a couple of them. I'll just go through what I think kind of are the five main things. One is to increase public confidence in elections. That's something that Representative Greenlook mentioned. If you're going to increase public confidence in elections, this process should be as transparent as possible, and I'll talk a little bit about that so that the public can kind of see what's happening so that they can get more confidence that their votes are being counted accurately. A second, obviously, is to deter any kind of fraud. If wrongdoers know that there's going to be a check on the votes, you already have full recounts in certain situations where there are very close elections. This is another check that is performed that will make somebody think twice before they do something to try to skew election results. A third important one is to detect big systematic errors. And an example of this that I often point to is in Wisconsin. They had a problem with their ballot marking devices, which they used for disabled voters. It was the ballot marking device was using the wrong kind of ink, and the optical scanners couldn't read that ink. Nobody knew this until they started conducting audits, and they saw that they were off by a couple of votes in every precinct, and they realized it was because the optical scanners, eventually they were able to track it down, weren't reading these particular votes. And that was a system-wide problem. I don't think anybody was claiming that it changed the results of any election, but it was certainly something important to know. Another is to provide feedback to election officials so that they can judge how the technology is performing, so that they can make improvements. Sometimes machines are miscalibrated or they get miscalibrated over the course of counting a large number of votes. Post-election audits can help point officials to those kinds of problems so that they're aware of them and so that they can make improvements in the future. John mentioned, you know, there are sometimes voters who will mismark ballots. Again, this is a good, knowing this is a good, generally a good thing. If you're seeing how voters are mismarking ballots, if you find there are typical problems when you're conducting audits, it's certainly something that's good to know for voter education in the future. And then the last thing is something that I think a lot of election integrity groups and statisticians are focused on, which is confirming to a high level of confidence that a full manual recount wouldn't change the results of the election. This is also often called statistical confidence and something that a lot of statisticians refer to. So those are the main areas, the main reasons, I think, to do audits. And I think people, when they're thinking about audits, different people have different priorities there. So in terms of where Oregon compares to other states, a couple of things to look at. The way I read this bill, it will only apply to general elections. I think in most cases, most states are doing this in both general elections and primaries that they hold. So that's one difference. The way I read this bill, it'll generally be three contests that you're auditing. That's somewhere in between. Some states like California and Illinois and West Virginia, as I'm sure many of you know, audit all of their contests. Some states like Hawaii and Florida will only do one. So again, I think that this is something that for the future, it's worth seeing how long this takes, how much it costs, and that might help you decide that you want to do less or more of these audits. Something else I wanted to mention in terms of that I think is very interesting about this bill is that at least for the contest that gets the most amount of votes in each county, there's an increase in the number of votes that will be hand counted. So if it's a very close race of just 1% margin between the candidates, 10% of the ballots will be recounted in those counties, and that's that is something that is unusual. Most states do not increase the audit as it gets closer, as the election is closer. I think that's a good thing. It certainly will increase confidence. Obviously, when there's a closer election, minor mistakes in reading of votes will make a bigger difference. So I think I mentioned earlier this concept of statistical confidence. There are a number of statisticians who would say that there are more efficient ways of doing this, that, you know, in this case we have, if a race is decided by under 2%, 5% of ballots will be hand counted. They might say that might be, in some cases that may be too many. There's a more efficient way of getting to what they would call a 99% confidence level. You might only have to audit 3% of precincts, depending on how it was done, to get a 99% confidence level at a full recount wouldn't change the results of the election. Again, this is something, the idea of using a statistical method with formulas or a more refined method for determining how many precincts should be audited might be something that you might want to look at in a pilot program, these other ideas that might allow you to find more efficient ways of auditing that would be more cost-effective. There is a bill in New Jersey, just as a point of reference, that recently passed that uses this kind of statistical basis for determining how many precincts should be audited. That is not something that has actually been done yet. Although they passed this post-election audit bill in New Jersey, they still don't have paper records. So it doesn't really mean much to require a hand recount when there isn't paper, obviously. But that's something, again, seeing what other states are doing might be worthwhile in terms of future refinements. I'm gonna wrap up because I've already gone on probably too long, but a big point that I wanted to make that I don't see in this bill or in the rules where I think that there could be a big improvement is on this whole point of transparency that I talked about. I think it's very important for the entire process, and that means from picking the precincts that are to be audited to watching the hand counts themselves. The public should be able to watch that. If we want the public to have greater confidence that this is actually adding integrity to the process, then we need to allow the public to watch. And on a couple of related notes, it's a little bit unclear to me why the precincts have to be, and maybe somebody else can answer this. I'm sure there's probably a reason for this, but why the precincts have to be picked so far in advance of when the audit is actually conducted. We have the precincts being picked, I believe, on election day or sometimes soon around election day, but the audit itself doesn't happen for 20 days. I would imagine that there's so much going on soon after the election that actually picking the precincts to be audited, it's just kind of another thing to be done that probably people have better ways to spend their time. And if we're not going to be conducting the hand count until 20 days later, it doesn't make a lot of sense to me. It could undermine public confidence. There was a situation in Cleveland in 2004 where there was a lot of advance notice for a hand recount that was done in 3% of the precincts. And their poll workers kind of matched up the ballots that they were going to be counting to the electronic tallies so that they wouldn't have to count anymore. And that led to a lot of a lot less public confidence when that was discovered in Cuyahoga County in Ohio in the whole electoral process. I'm not suggesting that anything like that would happen in Oregon, but again, if the idea is to increase public confidence and to deter fraud, then it seems to me waiting until you're actually going to do the audit to select the precincts probably makes a lot of sense. So I'll leave it at that.
Thank you. Any response, Representative Greenlick or John, to Mr. Norland's comments?
This is John Lindbeck again. I think that's an interesting point Mr. Norton just made in terms of the timing of when we picked the precincts. The result of that was that we just literally took what was in the federal bill. And we'll see how it works this session, and that may be a fix that we can make next time around if it doesn't work very well this cycle.
And any response on the transparency issue?
Well, I would like to respond. The votes are recounted in public according to Oregon statutes. The question in one of the proposals not to use a computer-generated random digit calculator is sort of funny. I'd like to ask any statisticians around if in their work they use 10-sided dies instead of using the computer to generate numbers. I mean, I think there is some transparency, but the fact is the computer-generated numbers just make sense and is done everywhere, and it's how you apply those numbers that is the issue. Two other things. The concept was we would try it first in general elections and get some sense of what's going on, how much it cost, and how it worked before we decided to apply it in primary elections, but that would clearly be a second step, primary and perhaps even special elections, after we saw how it worked. And I'd also like to comment on the relationship between statistical efficiency, which is based on reducing the variance in this sort of cluster sample model we're using here, to where we actually could probably use smaller sample sizes to achieve statistical efficiency. But we're talking about practical efficiency and public efficiency in this case. And in some cases, for example, the 10% sample is clearly more than we need to achieve statistical efficiency, but it does make sense in terms of achieving achieving public confidence in the outcome. So that's where those decisions came from in the original. Also, in terms of using some pilot studies, I think that would be a great idea. I'm a researcher, as you all know, so I always love to do research. I think we need to find a way to fund it outside of the general revenue of the state, however.
I was going to see if you were willing to do that one out of your pocketbook, Representative Greenleck.
I might.
Okay, good. John?
I have an idea, Madam Chair. Maybe the Brennan Center would be willing to
fund it. I do know that they provide grants for specific projects. Chair Rosenbaum.
Thanks, Madam Chair. And so I don't know, Mitch, if you have seen this, John, I'm sure you have, that we have actually a document that was given to us that's signed by, I think, 7 or 8 statisticians from mostly from Oregon. And I think they presented this as testimony in the rulemaking process. But they do, I mean, they make a number of technical suggestions, one of which isn't really technical, which is they don't like the use of that random number generator program, and I think they're saying that partly because they don't believe it can be a transparent public process, and they're suggesting some other method so that people could actually observe it. So I don't know if that was one of the things you're thinking about, but it certainly seems like if we want a process that everybody can be present for, that makes some sense. And then my other question was just, in their testimony they talk about the fact that the rules, or I guess the bill maybe, requires that the recount be announced not later than the day after the day of the general election. And, I mean, they're quoting from the rules, so I assume that is what the rules are proposing. I don't see, I guess maybe I don't have the bill in front of me, and I don't remember how exactly this works, but how could you know if the margin was close enough for a recount to be required until you've certified the results?
Well, one of the things that, Madam Chair, okay. You have several questions there. I'll address the last one first. And we did discuss that issue. I had the opportunity to go through the bill line by line with the clerks this summer, and we discussed a lot of those practical issues on how this would work. We decided that the rule will be amended so that the time delineated for determining which race is the one that receives the largest number of votes will be 5 o'clock the day after the election, which is a time that the clerks agreed that they had gone through almost all of their ballots. There are a few outstanding ballots, such as challenge ballots and so on, after that. But by 5 o'clock the day after, they have initially gone through the great bulk of their ballots. And we had, because of the time constraint in the bill, we had to pick a time that day that would be appropriate, and that was the time that the clerks thought would be the most appropriate.
And I'd like to comment on the first part of your question. Arlene Ash, who's the first signatory on this, is a dear friend of mine. We've worked together for more years than she wants to count. And she and I had a conversation about this. We had an email exchange a week or so ago. She's a fine statistician. But I really can't believe that she would suggest with a straight face that we use a 10-sided die to generate random numbers. I mean, it's well known to me that sometimes even the paranoids get persecuted, but in this case I think it carries paranoia to a level that is a little hard to contemplate. But 10-sided die would be fine.
We're going to get you for that.
If I can just add one thing.
Yes, Mr. Norden, go ahead.
I just wanted to mention in the pilots that we did in Ohio, we did use 10-sided dice, and as far as I know, that's also what they use in most counties in California or some similar kind of method.
No, I was asking whether anybody actually uses it in their real work.
Yeah. What was the answer?
I don't know a statistician that carries around a 10-sided die rather than a computer program, frankly.
Okay, thank you. And Senator Farrioli has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Greenlee, you opened your testimony by saying don't sacrifice the good on the altar of the perfect. And
I did say that.
I'm wondering, anytime the state creates a mandate that it's incumbent upon the counties to carry out, we're supposed to provide the funding as well. What's the funding source for this?
Well, I have to ask Mr. Lembeck that, but I can tell you that the county clerks universally endorsed this proposal, testified in favor of it at the time of the of its submission. John? How do we pay for it?
The county clerks did submit a fiscal statement. It was, I'm blanking out right now on what the threshold is in which something is considered not enough money that the legislature funds it, but it was under that threshold. The clerks are, I do have to speak for them here, they are concerned about the fact that they're not getting any money for this bill. For most of them, the number of ballots that they'll be hand recounting are pretty small. The number of the amount of time it will take is pretty small. But we'll be asking them to keep an accounting of their costs on this so that we have some real information on it.
Follow-up, ma'am.
Yes, please.
Are we putting some counties or all the counties at risk of not knowing if they'll need to do a recount until they know what the count is?
They will need to do a recount. The question is, how large a recount is it?
Well, as I read through the criterion, Madam Chair, what I saw was the closeness of the race determines the number of precincts to be recounted, the number of units to be recounted. And they will not know the closeness of the race until they've made their count. So it's possible that, at least it seems to me, that it's possible that county elections officials may end up having to add staff after the initial count.
Well, they know the minimum amount they're going to have to recount is 3%. And I think they'll be able to tell, you know, be a back of the envelope or throwing of the die calculation is how close, let's say, the presidential race is going to be in their county. You'll have a pretty good idea about that by 8 o'clock that night as to whether it'll be 3%, 5%, or 10%, 2%.
What's the bottom line?
3, 5, or 10%.
And Madam Chair, one more.
Yes, go ahead.
Will the counties always be recounting the presidential votes?
Well, they recount. The proportion is based on the race with the most ballots in their county. During a presidential race, it will certainly be during the presidential year, it will certainly be the presidential race. Likely in the other year, it'll be the governor's race. But it's whichever race in their county has the most ballots.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Did anybody get their questions?
Madam Chair, could I add just
one thing? John, go ahead.
In my conversations with the clerks this summer about this, I asked them to sort of project ahead. They all know their counties. Could they imagine their county, given the politics of their county, having a close race or a lopsided race in the presidential race? There were not very many clerks in Oregon who were sweating it. Most of them feel that the race in their respective county, that one candidate or the other, is going to win by a fairly substantial margin.
Madam Chair, there were over 500 people in Grant County, for instance, that voted for the Democratic challenger for president in the last presidential election.
That's good, Senator Farrioli.
There is hope, then. Senator Farrioli.
I think most counties are thinking that they'll likely be counting the minimum number under the law because of the politics of their county.
And actually, that is a question I had. In the testimony from the statisticians, they're quoting from the original bill that says that no more than 3 contests will be subject to audit under this law. Is it a limitation, even if there are more than that are within this close margin, that there wouldn't be a recount of any more than 3?
There wouldn't be a recount of any more than three contests in those in that first and second recount. If you uncover that you have a problem with your system, you're going to want to recount, believe me, everything.
And then there's a 1/8 to 1% as well. That would trigger an automatic recount. That's not changed by this statute.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both very much. And Mr. Norton, thanks for being available to us. It was very interesting, and we look forward to seeing the results of the auditing in after November.
So do I. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Appreciate all your assistance. All right. Last but not least, I'd like to bring up Justin Martin, Dr. John Koza, and Mr. Larry Sokol to talk about national popular vote. I don't know if you folks have had any exposure to this issue. I certainly have in my role at CSG. I think it's really interesting, and appreciate you all coming forward and my co-chair being willing to. You wanted to hear the issue. Well,
yes.
Is this an issue that we heard about in the 2007?
We did actually consider a bill on the House side.
Okay. All right. Take it away.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Justin Martin, and I am here today on behalf of National Popular Vote. The National Popular Vote bill guarantees that the candidate who gets the most popular votes in all 50 states wins the presidency. Currently, we have introduced the bill in 47 states across the country. 1,181 legislators have endorsed the plan. 21 legislative chambers have passed the bill. Four states have passed the bill where it has actually become law. Of those four states represent 50 of the 270 electoral votes needed to trigger the interstate compact so the national popular vote plan can take effect. Those four states are Hawaii, Illinois, New Jersey, and Maryland. And I'm very pleased today to introduce to you the originator of the plan, Dr. John Koza, and Larry Sokol with National Popular Vote. Thank you in advance for this opportunity to come in front of the committee again, and we look forward to the 2009 session.
Well, thank you, Senator Brown and Representative Rosenbaum, and the committee members for asking us to be here. As Justin said, the purpose of the bill is to guarantee that the candidate who gets the most popular votes in all 50 states becomes president. And the way the bill works, it has two parts. It says that when a state enacts this national popular vote bill, which is an interstate compact, it promises to award its electoral votes to the candidate who gets the most votes in all 50 states and the District of Columbia. The compact only goes into effect when states having a majority of the electoral votes enact the exact same compact. So, for example, the four states that have already enacted this are not affected in the 2008 election because we have, at the moment, 50 of the 270 electoral votes, 20%. But we're hopeful that that will change by 2012, and, of course, that's the reason we're here. Now, the shortcomings of the current system for electing the president stem from the winner-take-all rule. That's the Oregon law that says that you're going to award your seven electoral votes to the political party of the candidate who gets the most popular votes in Oregon. And 48 of the 50 states have that law. Maine and Nebraska do it by congressional district. Obviously, that law is not in the U.S. Constitution, or we wouldn't have two states doing it differently. In fact, only three of the original 13 states had anything like the winner-take-all rule in the first presidential election in 1789. So not only is this winner-take-all rule not in the Constitution, it was not the choice of the Founding Fathers or the political milieu at the time. Now, why is the winner-take-all rule bad? It's bad because the practical effect of it is that if you're running for president and a state is more than about 54-46 one way or the other, then you have no chance to win that state, or if you're ahead, you have no chance to lose that state in terms of practical politics. And three-quarters of the states are in that condition right now. We're sitting here today, several days before the first debate, less than a month after the two nominating conventions, and three-quarters of the states simply don't matter in the presidential election. Candidates have already decided that at most there's 14 states that they're concerned with, and in practical terms, it's more like 10. Now, in 2004, the candidates spent two-thirds of their money and two-thirds of their visits in just five states, five closely divided battleground states, and they spent 99% of their money in just 16 states. So in the 2004 election, two-thirds of the states were effectively left out of the process. Now, we're not frankly concerned with whose babies are kissed, whether babies in Oregon get kissed or babies in New Mexico and Ohio get kissed. But where this matters is issues. There are a lot of issues that affect the Northwest, timber, resources. There's a lot of issues that affect all three of the Pacific states, Washington, Oregon, and California, Pacific Rim trade, high technology. And these issues are not on the major list of issues of concern to presidential candidates because they simply don't matter in terms of getting into the White House. What does matter is the issues that affect Pennsylvania, Ohio, Michigan, New Hampshire, New Mexico, Wisconsin, Florida, this year for the first time Colorado, this year for the first time Virginia, and maybe Nevada. Those are the center of the presidential campaigns. And if you go to these websites, you can follow the candidates' visits. They are visiting those states. They're not coming out here except perhaps for fundraising. So the major shortcoming of the winner-take-all rule is that it leaves three-quarters of the states and three-quarters of the American public effectively as spectators to the presidential election. The other aspect of the winner-take-all rule is obviously it can result in the election of a candidate who gets the second-place number of votes. That has happened four times in 55 elections. That's a 1 in 14 failure rate. I was certainly glad that when I flew up here to Portland last night that I had better than a 1 in 14 chance of landing in Portland as opposed to in Boise. And in fact, it's worse than that because half of American presidential elections are landslides of 10% or more. So in fact, of the non-landslide elections, this problem affects 1 in 7 elections. So we should not have been surprised that there was a second-place winner elected in 2000 for the simple reason that we had a close election, non-landslide, in 88, 92, 96, 2000, 2004, and it certainly looks like 2008. Even in the elections that come out right, you can have close calls. Five of the last 12 elections, presidential elections, a shift of a few thousand votes in one or two states would have elected the second-place candidate. In 2004, a switch of 60,000 votes in Ohio would have elected John Kerry as president, even though Bush would still have been ahead by 3.5 million votes. So the system may seem like it works most of the time, but that's because presidential elections are every 4 years, and it takes quite a few years before you hit one of these events. This bill has been introduced in 47 states. It's been endorsed by a large number of publications and groups, the Chicago Sun-Times, the Minneapolis Star Tribune, Los Angeles Times, Boston Globe, Hartford Current, New York Times, Los Angeles Times, Common Cause, Fair Vote. More important, it's been endorsed by the voters. The Gallup poll has been asking questions about popular elections since they ran their first poll in 1944, and it's been above 70% nationally consistently. There are polls on our website galore, They're all above 70%. There was a recent Washington Post, Harvard University poll, 72% favor direct election. That includes 62% of Republicans, 75% of independents, and about 70% of Democrats. And we've done statewide polls in 11 states, battleground states, small states, southern states, and we get those same numbers. We have a national advisory board consisting of people from both parties, former Senator Jake Garn from Utah and Congressman John Buchanan from Alabama, Republicans, Tom Campbell from California, Republican, Senator Birch Bayh, who was a leading spokesman for this when he was in the Senate in the 60s and 70s, Tom Downey, a congressman from the former congressman from New York. We have a book, which I think all of you already have, and of course, a website, nationalpopularvote.com. Thank you very much for your attention and for asking us here today.
Questions? Representative Thatcher.
Thank you. I have a kind of a three-part question. We just went through a long testimony regarding hand recounts and recounts when things are close. I'm wondering what kind of mechanism would trigger a recount and how one would conduct a national recount. And if you'd have to conduct a national recount, wouldn't that necessitate a federal control on what is now a state control as far as elections are concerned?
Well, Senator Brown and Rosenbaum answering the question. If you're concerned about recounts, you should love the National Popular Vote bill. First of all, this is a states' rights bill. It's based on the state's exclusive power given in the Constitution for the states to determine the manner of electing the president. Secondly, it's based on retaining all the existing state control over elections, including recounts. But in terms of recounts, what's important is that recounts are quite rare. That is, real recounts and real disputes. In a recent study of 7,645 statewide elections, the chance of a recount is 1 in 332 elections. So if you have a single pool of votes, the chance of a recount in a national election should be once in 1,300 years. And although I'm working out and trying to stay in good health, I don't expect to encounter that. Now, the reason that question comes to mind in presidential elections is because we've heard of all the disputes over the years in presidential elections. And the reason that happens is that every single presidential election is 51 separate elections. So that even though we've only run 55 presidential elections since 1789, that's actually been 2,087 separate elections. And lo and behold, if you apply the 1 in 300 and some probability of that, you find out that, yes, we had a serious recount in Florida in 2000 that went to court. Yes, we had a serious recount in Hawaii in 1960 that went to court and reversed the original outcome. And, of course, in the Tilden Hayes election, we had a close count in South Carolina, and there's been a close disputed count in Louisiana and Florida. That's 5 out of 2,000, almost exactly in line with the predicted 1 in 332. So in terms of recounts, first of all, the states retain their control. There's nothing in this 800-word bill which changes the fundamental state control of every aspect of elections, as has always been the case. And secondly, we will do a better job of preventing recounts simply because we'll have a single pool of votes. No one would have cared who carried Florida by 537 votes in 2000 if the national pool had been counted, because it was 537,000 votes. Nobody would have cared who carried Illinois and Hawaii and South Carolina in 1960, because the margins in those states were 4,500 in two of them and 115 votes in Hawaii in 1960, much smaller than Kennedy's 120,000 vote margin. So the reason recounts pop up in your mind is that you're used to hearing them about in presidential elections, and that's because of the deeply flawed method we currently have of treating each election as 55 or 51 separate elections.
Great question. Representative Buckley.
Hold on, my chair here. Thank you, Madam Chair. Jim, I think we asked this last time this was brought up, but what would you say to the argument, though, that if we go to the popular vote, then it's going to be a campaign at the centers on California and New York and Texas and states that have larger numbers that candidates can reach, and states like Oregon will still be ignored, or states like Utah won't get visits from candidates?
They will get visits because a vote is a vote. Just as when you're running in the state of Ohio right now for president, you don't see McCain and Obama focusing solely on Cleveland, ignoring the rest of Ohio. Every vote matters inside Ohio, and they will spend an average of 6 visits per congressional district, all 18 districts, in the next 2 months, as they did in 2004, making sure that every vote gets dug up that they can dig up in Ohio. So it is not true that big cities or rural areas or suburbs or exurbs get the upper hand. Well, people who get the upper hand are the voters, because every single vote matters. Another good way to look at it is they make about 450 visits, or they did in 2004, between the convention and the election, which is almost the number of congressional districts, which is 435. Now, if you were running and you had 435 precincts, as a starting point, you wouldn't just campaign in Salem. You wouldn't just campaign in downtown Salem. You would go to the precincts that are wherever they are, out in the suburbs, or maybe even there's rural portions of your district. The point is, you would give attention in accordance with the number of votes that are there to your whole jurisdiction. And that's what happens in governor's races. Example I like is that Governors Reagan, Dukmejian, Wilson, and Schwarzenegger, they didn't just campaign in Los Angeles and San Francisco, and they didn't win those places in any election, but they won the governorship because they and their Democratic opponent campaigned everywhere in the state, because every vote was just as good as any other.
Good answers. Thank you.
Representative Berger?
No, I have no particular comment, except that I think we need to look. We are in a part of a country that never has gotten in my lifetime any attention to the kind of issues, as he started out, that concern us as a voting bloc. And it's just not Oregon. It's Washington, Oregon, Idaho, Montana. We have a bunch of issues that never get addressed in any of the national conversations during the presidential year. I'm looking for ways to get our issues on the national table. I think that the rural schools crisis speaks to the fact that if this were happening in other states, it would get a lot of attention. But it's happening here, and it's getting none. And so I really applaud this as a way of getting our issues on the national stage, so we may not see candidates as often as Ohio and Florida and Pennsylvania, but at this point, we're not seeing candidates at all.
I'm curious, Diane, Chair Rosenbaum, I'll come back to you if you have a question, but I want to follow up on Representative Berger's comment about the Northwest getting attention. And the National Secretary of State's Association has been looking at the primary process and regional rotating primaries, and I think there's some other formats of that out there. Have you thought about the multiple? I mean, I think we would like to see attention in the Northwest, and I guess my concern would be that sort of the multiple impacts of those kinds of changes to the system. Your thoughts on the regional rotating primaries, does that assist? Does that help? Does that enhance what you're trying to do? Your thoughts on that?
Well, Senator Brown and Representative Rosenbaum, I think the way the primaries were conducted this year, and particularly, I might say, on the Democratic side, which, for good or ill, because of their proportional rule, the process continued through all 50 states. It gave people a taste of a presidential campaign. For example, on February 5th, there were 22 states that suddenly were getting attention, including California, which hasn't seen a presidential candidate except for fundraising for probably two decades. So that people got excited about this. Registration went up. Participation went up. In North Carolina, it created a sensation to have a contest there for the first time, because that's a state that's reliably Republican, and Democrats don't even bother showing up there generally, as is true with three-quarters of the states. So even though there's no connection between the primary issue and the general election, it's given people a taste of the fact that it's nice to be noticed. Your state is a good example of a state that's doubly ignored, because you have 7 electoral votes. Oklahoma, Iowa, Connecticut have 7 electoral votes. But you cast, in 2004, 1,007,000 votes for president. They all cast 1,005,000. That's because of your higher civic interest and, frankly, higher education, and probably partially due to your mail voting. But you are especially underrepresented in terms of your percentage of the popular vote is higher than your percentage of the electoral vote, because you're a high participation state.
Interesting. Chair Rosenbaum.
Although we certainly weren't ignored in the primary.
Primary, no.
In Oregon.
And you weren't
this
ignored
time.
In the primary because the presidential candidates knew they could get delegates here. So they came here, and suddenly they had a briefing book about Oregon, and they had a briefing book about Montana and South Dakota, which I think were in that last couple of weeks, as I recall.
Yeah.
They actually briefly cared about South Dakota, but they sure don't care now. And the important point is not just how they get elected. When they step into that Oval Office on January 20th, they're thinking of re-election. So for the next 4 years, the issues that are going to be at the top of their mind are not Pacific Rim trade or timber or semiconductors that are produced in Idaho and Texas and Arizona, none of which are battleground states. What's going to be on the top of their mind is how is this going to play in those closely divided battleground states.
Well, I think this really is an innovative approach to trying to get to something that, to me, should be being done at a national level, and I guess because amending the Constitution isn't very easy, especially not the federal Constitution. It hasn't happened that way. I just want to say, when I think this happened about 30 years ago, I was sitting around about this time of the year at a barbecue and had some friends who had a 5-year-old there. We were talking about the presidential election, and my friends whose kid ended up growing up to be an English professor at Harvard or something leaned over and said, "Daniel, do you understand the Electoral College?" And then proceeded to explain it to him. And I don't think there was any adult sitting there who actually understood what the Electoral College was or how it was supposed to work. But I guess my question to you really is, it seems like there are so many aspects of electing a president, or maybe the way we do elections in general in this country, that are not standardized state by state. And you mentioned the primaries, and you look at the primaries, and the difference between a caucus state versus a state that actually has a regular election for the primary, the eligibility criteria that are used very radically state by state in terms of when you can register to vote. I mean, it seems like there's a whole host of changes that need to happen to the election process in this country in a modern age when we have computers and we're using statewide databases to verify people's eligibility and stuff like that. So I guess, I mean, it's certainly innovative and I support it, but it does seem like it's only one of many things that really do need to change. So I'm not sure, I didn't end with a question.
Well, Senator Brown and Representative Rosenbaum, let me just quote the previous people, let's not make the perfect the enemy of the good. We're trying to solve one particular problem that 70% of the public has wanted for decades and certainly wants today, which is the electing of the president. There is a national consensus, albeit subject to inertia, but there is a national consensus on the solution, which is elect the president the same way we elect every other official in the United States. The primary is a problem, but as these plans have been proposed, which sound very meritorious, there have many details and complications, and we're certainly not competent to even comment on them.
Madam Chair, as far as the primaries go, my perspective on it is whether states move their primary up to be more relevant or because of the length, particularly of the Democratic primary process. This time, states became relevant at the end. That was, you know, a unique experience, and it got a lot of energy and it got a lot of people excited. And now, in three-quarters of the states, that excitement and energy is completely dissipated because the job was only halfway done. States became relevant in the primary process, but not relevant in the general process. Okay. And to make states relevant in the general election is you need to go to a national popular vote.
Okay. I appreciate that. Thank you. Senator Farrioli.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do have, you know, we met earlier today. I've expressed some skepticality, and I've told these gentlemen I'm going to study the issue. But I feel compelled to ask, who's funding this national program?
Well, I'm the largest single contributor of the program, by far.
Is that subject to any reporting requirements?
We're nonprofit C4, but I've just given you the report.
I'm sure they would accept contributions, Senator Farrioli, if you're interested.
Yes, operators will be standing by to receive your...
Senator Farrioli.
I think we've all been hearing about the Electoral College since the Eisenhower years.
Well, some of us have.
Every 4 years. Every 4 years, people get all bunched up about the Electoral College and say, you know, and it's one of those things, gosh, it's like the weather. You know, everybody wants to do something about it. Nobody does anything. But the states have already chosen the mechanism for electing the presidents. They've already exercised their franchise in this regard. And I can show you a number of polls. And we've had a number of 65% measures pass and be amended immediately following. 65% of Oregonians loved Measure 37, just like 65% of them loved 49. You know, and I'm sure there's some 65% polls we can all look at. But this doesn't require a constitutional change to implement. It only requires an interstate compact. And so the question I would have is, people are so sure that a referral would result, an advisory vote by the citizens of Oregon, would result in a positive vote. I would suggest that that might be a debate worth having with the citizens of Oregon about whether they want to change the way our electrical system operates. And, you know, maybe this winner-take-all thing just plumb goes away. And wouldn't that be an interesting exercise within the building as well?
Interesting. But
thanks.
I appreciate that response in terms of providing it as a referral to the voters. I think it's worth having a conversation
about. Just an
advisory
vote.
No, I think it's really interesting. So, any other comments?
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Representative.
Oh, Representative Hunt, I'm like... Mr. Sorno, I thought you were gone a long time ago. Sorry. Go ahead.
No problem. I appreciate the testimony. You continue to support the idea. The one question that came to my mind, actually, as you were testifying, you mentioned about the fact that it doesn't go into place until states representing a majority of the electoral votes have approved it. Have you thought out the provision if, you know, you got a simple majority, maybe 200 and states representing 275 electoral votes, pass it, the compact then goes into place. Is there any provision for what would happen if one of the states then backed out, thereby dropping us back below the majority of electoral votes?
Great question, Representative Hunt. Go ahead.
Indeed, as Senator Brown and Representative Rosenbaum and Representative Hunt. first of all, like most interstate compacts, a state can leave the interstate compact in the same way it enters by simply repealing the ordinary state law that allowed it, caused it to enter the compact. But like most interstate compacts, we have a blackout period on when you can withdraw. And any withdrawal between July 20th of a presidential year and January 20th, that six-month period between that basically includes the conventions, the campaign, the meeting of the Electoral College, the meeting of Congress, and the inauguration date, you can't withdraw during that period. Because it's an interstate compact, it's legally binding and on the legislatures involved. So while the legislatures are free to leave if, for example, they become dissatisfied with a national popular vote, they can't leave in that six-month period in the midst of a campaign. And that provision is also buttressed by existing federal law having to do with the fact that the states can't change, mm-hmm. under the current system, their decision on how to award electoral votes between Election Day and the meeting of the Electoral College under the current system.
Okay, thank you.
Can I ask a follow-up answer?
Sure.
That's a very helpful answer. Have you thought about the possibility that a state would adopt a slightly differently worded version of the count? Has that been an issue anywhere, or have people just been debating yes or no on the language of the compact?
Well, an interstate compact is a contract, so it has to be identical, word for word, between the parties, just as a bill that's passed by your House and your Senate have to be identical, or they simply haven't passed it. So if you change one word in this compact, you're not adopting it. You're adopting some other compact.
Okay. Basically,
it's a contract, and all the parties around the table have to sign on the same piece of paper.
Great. Anybody else? Well, thank you very much. We appreciate Senator Farioli. Did you want to state that?
I did. Okay. I just wonder if we're not entering the era of rock star presidencies, where it truly is a national popularity contest.
Well, until Jesse Ventura is a serious candidate for president, I'm not too concerned.
Why? So. What's the matter with Jesse Ventura?
Nothing. So, Dr. Koza, Mr. Sokol, thank you very much for joining us in Oregon. Travel safely, and we look forward to this continuing conversation. I assume that there has been a draft of the legislation already requested. I'm getting head nods so that there will be something introduced in the 2009 session. So, committee doesn't need to take any action at this point. Thank you very much. Anything further to come before the committee?
Madam Chair, I just wanted to tell committee members that I don't know if we've formally got a date now for our October meeting, do we?
We want you to talk after the meeting.
Okay. But there will be another meeting in October. I believe the intention is to have half a day of it be the joint House and Senate Rules Committees continuing our work on ethics and getting some additional public comment on Senate Bill 10. We still have some witnesses who did not get to testify when we were in Pendleton, and they will be coming here to Salem to tell us what they think. And then I think the other half of the day would be another meeting, a joint elections meeting. I think that at that meeting there will be some potential bill introductions for committee bills.
Yes.
Then I know on the Senate side the deadline to do that is October 31st, so I know that Senator Devlin intends to have some bills. And obviously, committee members on the House side, if you have things that you want to propose as House committee bills, we don't have that October 31st deadline, but the sooner we have drafts in, the sooner we can act on them. So keep me posted.
Happy to introduce Senate committee member bills as Senate committee bills at that committee hearing, too, as well. So, and hopefully we'll have a lunch break in between the two so you guys all don't die of starvation. So, all right. Thank you very much. With that, we adjourn. Everyone travel safely and enjoy this little bit of fall sunshine.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
I hope the four changes are not let you know something.